host David Smith, and joining me tonight are Mr. Alistair Yule and Jim Lamming. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi there.
Sorry we've been away so darn long. Lots of personal circumstances, getting of away, that sort of thing. But hey, as a first for this show, we're covering some comedy tonight. Quite a lot of it too. This evening we're talking all things Cornetto, Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost trilogies. How's that for a slice of fried gold? But before we get to that, let's catch up on some other things we've been watching. So Jim, I'm going to start with you. What have you been watching?
I got to see the new Doctor Strange film, Multiverse of Madness, at the weekend, and it was a hoot. I was quite looking forward to it anyway, because I'm actually quite a fan of Scott Derrickson's Doctor Strange film. It surprised me quite a lot at just how good it was and how great the visuals were. So, you know, one directed by a horror master is going to be very much up our street. And it didn't disappoint, especially in terms of a lot of parallels to his previous films. Without wanting to give too much away, there is definitely some nods to Evil Dead and that sort of thing in there.
Oh, yeah.
There is quite a lot I'd like to talk about, but won't for the sake of spoilers. But I will say, considering it's a multiverse film and what we had with the recent Spider-Man one, it definitely goes easy on the self-referential stuff, the characters that they put in there, because it could have been basically another Ready Player One for what it's worth. So I was actually quite relieved by how restrained it was in terms of what characters they threw in there, because I thought we were going to get the kitchen sink and everything. But considering the scope of everything, it was pretty reined in.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely, because on one hand, I was almost a bit disappointed that that's what it was. I sort of thought this was going to have a bit more fun with hypotheticals, like, oh, what if this character meets this character? And, oh, here comes some other licensed Disney characters just show up or something like that. You know, but at the same time, it felt more focused on that. You know, it was a better film than I thought it was going to be. Did I say that as someone who really didn't like the original? I think the horror aspects worked brilliantly. I think, now that we're not watching Doctor Strange mastering his powers, which he seems to do pretty darn quickly in the original, we're just seeing a guy who already has them. And I think it sort of let us explore a lot more possibilities. Without going into spoil territory, this was one of the better Marvel villains. But I've seen some people complain that they have to watch one of the TV shows, without saying which of the TV shows, one of the TV shows you have to watch before you see this one. Now, on one hand, part of me is like, the film should stand up by itself. At the same time, though, I quite like this as being like a multimedia experience. You know, I can't think of anything else that's done this in the history of entertainment, or certainly not to the same level, having this kind of intertextuality between different parts of the same franchise. For some people, don't get me wrong, it is going to be irritating, and it potentially makes a trip to the cinema a lot less fun than it otherwise could be. But at the same time, I think it's quite rewarding if you do make the time to watch the shows.
Just to touch on what you said there, Jim, about the... Now, I'll put my hands up and say that I've actually not seen Doctor Strange 2 yet. But when you were saying that it's a more restrained film than you're expecting, and they didn't throw everything, including the kitchen sink, I would say the marketing for this film's counter to that, because it looks like they are throwing everything at it. It looks like a kitchen sink-type film, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, in fact, I was going to say as well that the trailer is kind of misleading. Obviously, you see some of the characters that are going to be in there, but unless I just completely blanked it, if memory serves, they don't even show one of the main characters in the trailer. And, you know, everything that goes on just feels completely different to what was teased, I suppose, which is a brilliant thing, because I was kind of apathetic towards it. You know, it didn't really do it for me, but you know, I was going to go and see it anyway.
And I've definitely had experience of trailers ruining too much of the film for me. That's definitely
yeah.
True.
I'll be coming towards that in just a few moments, but on this one, like it was I agree, because it was surprising that most of the film takes place in just like two worlds. I thought there was going to be a lot more of like, ooh, going between the dimensions.
Would it be fair to say that two doesn't qualify as multiple? or multiverse.
Well, we do see more than just a handful, but for the most part, yeah, it is. I would say it feels more like a 90s superhero film than anything, because back then they would have just had it set in those specific areas because of budgetary constraints, or you know, they just didn't have the technology to show all these many expansive worlds that we see these days. So again, that's where that feeling of restraint comes in. It's you know, it's just, they've got this big sandbox, but they're just going to keep it tight in these locations here. So you know, I really appreciated that side of it, because I do feel like it could have gone down the, you know, remember this guy, oh it's that dude, and hey this guy's here again. I feel we've had far too much of that in films recently, and it felt like a breath of fresh air for not doing that.
It is. Something I was wondering about with this is, we had Scott Derrickson, of course, Hellraiser Inferno, Scott Derrickson, drop out of a project as it was coming along. Now, when you see the monsters in this, it really just feels like a Sam Raimi film. And I'm wondering how much, if any, creative input he would have really had to the story that it's telling, because it's a really good match between director and material. But I'm wondering if that was just a case of he would do this justice, as opposed to let's have him on to fundamentally reshape it. Because we had that with Ant-Man. We're going to be talking about Edgar Wright tonight. Edgar Wright left the movie because he felt like the vision was being too constrained. And I'm wondering here with Sam Raimi, if he was kind of like a camera for hire, a very, very good camera for hire, but also did he just say, all right, I'm coming in, this is what the third act's going to look like?
It's a good question. I mean, obviously Scott Derrickson got a producer credit on there, but there's a lot on there that is Sam Raimi's style. Like, say, his Spider-Man films, for example, you'd get a few scenes where they're trying to show a lot of story at once, so they'll have overlapping layers of the editing. So there's that character in this situation there and there on the screen at the same time. Then there's a divide between the two. You see a bit of that sometimes. And then you've just got the great finale. I don't want to spoil it, but there's a great finale that's very Evil Dead. And you know, it's his stamp on there. Is like a lot of these Marvel films, you know, it could be any, I could have directed it for all anyone's concerned, because it's shot in a warehouse with green walls and floors, you know, and then you've just got the special effects crew doing the rest of it. But this had his signature on it, no doubt about it.
You know, one other thing I want to add about this film is I really want to see a movie where we've got a female superhero whose superpower does not revolve around being unable to control her emotions. Because that's free for free that we now have at this point.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah. American Chavez, his whole thing is, oh, I go through the multiverse if I get stressed. You know, we've got Wanda who's like, don't stress me out, I'm going to blow shit up. And then Captain Marvel was the case of, all right, you need to learn to master your emotions, because right now you're unpredictable and keep on hurting people.
And, you know, misogyny in disguise.
it's free for free. I know we've got the Hulk on the side for the men as well. We're like, this guy, you don't really want to be around him when he gets pissed off, right?
I think, to be fair, that's like one guy out of how many guys who can control their emotions.
Exactly, like, you know, Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, these guys are very emotionally adjusted. Anyway.
I suppose they get upset, but their powers aren't directly connected thematically to their emotions and the lack of control thereof.
Exactly. It's pissing me off at this point. I'm like, okay, so this has happened too often for it just to be a coincidence. You know, don't be wrong, there'll be people going, the film's actually really woke if you look at it, because of American Chavez, she's a girl. And you go, you're like, okay, but her entire personality and all her powers come from an inability to control her emotions, right? You probably wouldn't have that for three men in a row, right? As you said, versus the Hulk is our exception. Anyway, what else have you been watching, Jim?
Recently, I watched The Raid again. It's been overdue for a rewatch. Not going to lie, I was trying to watch Sonic the Hedgehog 2, but that didn't happen. I was watching it with the little one. So I thought, you know what? We both do karate. Let's watch a martial arts film. And maybe it was a little gorier and, you know, a little more violent than I remembered it being, but those were her favourite bits, so, you know.
Just put this in
from the same cloth.
When you say you watched it with the little one, how young is the little one?
Well, not so little anymore. She's 10. But, you know, she wouldn't normally say boo to a goose. Yeah, it's kind of 50-50 when you're going into these. Like, I mean, going back to Doctor Strange, a lot of people say, no, it's not suitable for kids. It's too much horror in there. She was fine with it. She hates horror, but she absolutely loved Doctor Strange. So, but yeah, her favorite bits of the raid were the corridor fight scene where he's basically eviscerating some of the attackers with a knife, you know, getting them down the thighs, in the back of the neck and all sorts. She's,
it's an interesting film for a 10-year-old. What are you going to follow that up with, Judge Dredd?
Well, it'd be thematically similar, wouldn't it? So you never know.
Alistair, are you much of a fan of The Raid? Because personally, I would call it one of the best martial arts films I've ever seen in my life.
It's a tremendous film. I absolutely love that movie. It's had a friend around. We watched both The Raid 1 and Raid 2 back-to-back, and they're absolutely kick-ass. There's no way to sort of put it any other way. They are kick-ass films. The ones, I think they're the type of film as well that you could only really make something visually as kinetic and as with as much impact like that when you haven't got, say, the Western, say, safety regulations. Because, like, all of these hits look like they connect. Even when one of the characters is holding a knife, it's rough. It's rough and it's visceral in a way that I think Western movies just aren't.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've seen quite a few martial arts films in my time, and a lot of the Thai ones tend to be definitely a little more full on. Obviously, you got the 80s Hong Kong cinema, which, you know, again, I have very little concern for the health and safety of their stunt people, but in terms of modern films, definitely the Thai films tend to just push it that little bit further. I'm a big fan of the sequel as well, The Raid 2. I think I prefer that more, especially that highway chase. It's absolutely fantastic. The camera work in that is magnificent.
I'll tell you, because I've watched The Raid with a few folk and The Raid 2 with a friend of mine. And when we're watching it, because we'll watch any violent Western film, and it's sort of same old during the violent scenes. But in The Raid and Raid 2, me and I know a few others as well, we sort of found ourselves going, ooh, during that, like, it looks so real.
I'm thinking of that bit where that dude gets chucked over the stairs, snaps his back on the
that's a big one. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's that fast. They've definitely landed a few punches in there. I mean, like, you can tell, like, you've got stage fighting and then you've got that. But yeah, these guys probably, you know, they all fight for a living by the looks of it. So, you know, they're made of tough stuff and can take a few hits, that's for sure. But I can imagine health and safety definitely goes out the window when filming those.
Any others you want to share with us?
Just a rewatch of Ghostbusters Afterlife. That's recently hit Sky Cinema, so gave that a watch at the weekend. Again, pretty decent, but overall fairly middling. You know, it's a decent kids' adventure movie, but when you incorporate the nostalgia of Ghostbusters, it kind of it's weighed down by its own self-importance. Entertaining enough, but too stuck in the past at the same time.
All right. I'm going to go through. I've got a bit of an extensive list here, so strap in. The Northmen is my film of the year so far. I cannot recommend this one enough. It's a pitch-black revenge film that really takes this idea of machismo and honour and just dismantles the whole fucking thing. It's so much darker than I thought it would be. You know when you hear, like, oh, the lead's a bit of an anti-hero in this film, and the movie's like Constantine or something. This gets properly dark. Like, you're watching going, oh, that was a bit uncalled for. You know, oh, I don't know, this feels very morally conflicted here. So yeah, The Northman is just outstanding. You know, for Robert Eggers, this is three brilliant movies. And I gotta say, this is his biggest cinematic achievement for me. Possibly prefer The Lighthouse, but this one is just, for what it does with the subgenre, for the sheer scale of it, it's absolutely breathtaking, and I will totally be buying this one on Blu-ray. Absolutely outstanding soundtrack as well. Next up is X. X is the latest Ty West film. It's a back-to-basics grindhouse horror 70s style. It's his best movie, I reckon. By far his best-paced one. Got good stalking scenes, you've got likeable characters, you've got absolutely shitloads of tension in it. So very, very good. Alive comes next, which is a fairly shallow zombie film. It's a Netflix one from South Korea. And while you've got some individually cool scenes with the zombies, the social commentary is a bit shallow. And it just kind of feels like it's a whole film about nothing. Like, the use of social media, and it's relatively novel, I suppose, if it's a fresh angle, it's the use of technology. But at the same time, as a zombie film, there's, you know, zombie films are only as interesting as their human characters. Something we'll be coming to in just a wee bit with Shaun of the Dead. But for this one, it just doesn't really have that. It doesn't, you don't have the connection between the leads. It doesn't help that they don't share a room for most of the movie. Fresh, decent dating horror, probably work better as a half hour short. Oh, Morbius. One of you guys must have seen Morbius, right?
Right, not heard good things about it. The only good thing I have heard about it was about Matt Smith's performance as the villain. I believe the villain's called Milo.
Yes, he is the best thing in this piece of shit film. Like, it's amazing. The whole thing is just going past 150 miles per hour. You know, it's we don't experience his transformation at all, because like everything seems to happen from the first, like, you know, like it goes from this plot point to this plot point to this one, and then a twist that all but the least observant viewer will see coming comes about halfway through the film. And it ain't good. Jim, have you watched this yet?
I've not managed to catch it. I was pretty hyped for it, in all honesty, even knowing how badly it reviewed. In fact, the terrible reviews made me want to see it even more.
Yeah, that was my feeling on this one. I thought, like, this will be a bit of a laugh. And the thing is, it's probably a little bit too, like, so it's a little bit too boring, a little bit too safe to be a laugh. You know, there's no sort of, so, like, what would we call a movie that's sort of so pish it's good, but is doing something quite innovative? Like, The Room.
The Room.
For instance. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's a bit of an extreme.
With The Room, I think The Room works because the whole thing just seems so sincere. Whereas,
yeah. I think I would say The Room, it actually works because we have a very, I would say, cinema savvy audience. So they've seen these scenes in other movies. They know what the director's aiming for. And they can see how wide a swing and a miss this is in every single scene of the film. And it's almost delightfully bad.
I think maybe Tommy Wiseau would have probably made a better Morbius, though.
Well, now I have to see Morbius. You're tearing me apart, Morbius.
Where The Room is just kind of like, you know, It's this attempt at doing like a quite serious drama piece, and also a sort of exploration of this strange sexism of the man who created it. It's also kind of exceptional, just in the way that we'll just chuck in like, oh, I've got breast cancer, if I do nothing else with it, right? You know, like, I think The Room is a movie that could not have been made by anyone else, and you could not design it to make it funny. It's something that works because it's so serious. Whereas I think of Morbius, this is one of those movies that's almost 100% pure product. It's not there for anyone to like it. It's there to be watched. It's there to start off a franchise. Yes. And you're looking at, like, it's weird seeing a superhero film that's about 80 minutes long nowadays, right? You just think, someone couldn't be arsed developing this script. And it shows. And also with Jared Leto, I don't know how much you guys have been following with the making of Morbius, but apparently Jared Leto...
I think I know what you're about to say. I hope we're all sitting down for this.
Jared Leto would pretend to be disabled on set, so people would have to help him get to the bathroom and stuff so he could get in character. I don't want to touch... For legal reasons, we're not going to touch upon the rumours about Jared Leto, but at the same time, there's just something so, so wankerish about that behaviour. Mm. And what's about method acting? You never get method actors going like, oh yeah, I went method to play this really nice guy. It's like, no, you only ever go method if you're being a total asshole.
Now, again, this is a film that I've not seen myself. I've seen the trailers, though. And unless the trailers are lying, I do believe that the Morbius character flies during it. Did Jared Leto's method acting extend to flying?
Oh,
that's my honest question.
I hope it did. With Jared Leto, it's quite funny that he's not been in a Marvel film yet, or MCU one, and presumably will not be.
From what I could tell about, quote-unquote Hollywood, it seems to me that you're in one or the other. The one or the other being DC or Marvel. And he was cast as the Joker, which is, let's be honest, that character is the greatest villain that DC has ever presented on the pages of a comic book. And possibly a better villain than Marvel has ever themselves come up with.
I completely forgot he was in
that. That was a thing that happened.
Probably a repressed memory more than anything.
We did a show on it. Can you imagine? You're an Oscar winner, right? You're trying to make your way into superhero films because you're making the big bucks, and you end up doing the Joker in Suicide Squad and Morbius.
To be fair, I reckon they've probably gone off the Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s because that was a good story arc. I remember that one. That kept me invested every Saturday morning.
I'd say there's two types of Marvel films. There's the Disney MCU that starts with the big Marvel banner and all the images of the previous movies from the Avengers onwards. And there's what you could say call the MCU adjacent films, which let's say would include, I think it's the 2003 Hulk film. It would include the Venom movies. It would also include the Marvel, and retroactively, it would include the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films and Andrew Garfield Spider-Man films.
And Fantastic Four. Mm.
Yes.
Who can forget Fantastic Four?
Well, actually, that's another one I watched recently, thinking about it. We'll leave it at that.
with Fantastic Four, something that's fascinating about that film is it's a movie that doesn't have a second act. Like, You got the whole thing where the Fantastic Four, you got the sort of nice little body horror sequences, they get all their powers. Then it's like, a year later, they storm a military base with full powers. You're like, oh, I thought we'd have them, like, getting used to this kind of thing, you know?
Well, actually, the first film just feels like the first act, and then they defeat the baddie at the end, who just appears.
Yeah, so this is the Josh Trank.
Oh, sorry, I was talking about the good one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't seen these ones. I heard the Silver Surfer one's quite cool.
Yeah, the good, bits of fluff. Like, back when superhero films were still kind of B-movies, that sort of thing. But yeah, the Josh Trank one is, you're right, that's a great body horror film, and then just shits the bed entirely. It just gets so boring after the initial, acquisition of powers and that sort of thing. It gets pretty dark, and then just that's it. It's just.
I think the making of it's quite interesting. Josh Trank obviously got the gig off the back of Chronicle, really good found footage. And this was going to be setting up a new Star Wars movie for him, I believe. And then you just see the way that he seemed to behave with the cast members. It just looked like everybody involved had a really, really bad time. And then, yeah, he gets the Star Wars films cancelled, Fantastic Four flops. And I believe he made an Al Capone biopic a couple of years ago, which was meant to be all right. But at the same time, it's Chronicles showed real potential. And then, it's what happens, I guess, when you get like an indie filmmaker. And then you give them a massive mainstream platform and they kind of lose their voice somewhere in it, which brings me to another movie that I saw recently, Firestarter. So Firestarter, you've got the director of The Vigil makes this. I wrote a big long review on the website, everyone, so go check it out. But basically, you're looking at, I would say, a very middle of the road King adaptation. Now, it's not got the strongest source material, so that's not necessarily surprising. But there's so much packed into this 90 minutes here that it makes me wonder if there's a lot of deleted scenes and they were aiming to try and pack it into an hour and a half, or if they were just having to cut the script as they went due to shooting constraints. But either way, it feels half done, basically. The unbearable weight of massive talent. This is quality. Really good chemistry between the cast members, although it's not particularly... Nicolas Cage doesn't really take a piss out of himself that much. We don't really talk about some of his worst movies. I was expecting a bit of like Ghost Rider banter, you know, or maybe expecting a bit more of a sort of look at his straight-to-DVD movies, that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, he does a good job of sort of playing up to what people expect from a performance by him. The only problem I had with this film is it's where the trailer showed far too much, because one of the biggest sources of tension of the movie, the trailer gives away the ending of that. And that bothered me. I mean, it's a good movie, should be seen as blind as possible if you haven't seen that trailer about 100 times at the cinema. Yeah, last one is You Are Not My Mother. It's creepy, it's well acted, it's a really nice little low-budget Irish horror, but it also lacks characterization and drama. Like, there's enough in there that makes me think the director's going to come out with something really good next, but this isn't quite there. Elster, what have you been watching lately?
Well, I recently checked out the film Dark City from 1998, and I suppose my reasoning for this was, I think late last year, the fourth Matrix film came out, and being a Matrix aficionado from back in late 90s, early noughties, I thought I would, I was actually quite anticipating, looking forward to the new Matrix film. And not to talk about that film, I was disappointed. But I don't think I'm alone on that front. But I decided to check out Dark City, as it has been on a lot of fronts compared to or comparable to the original Matrix. And there's certainly similarities, not just in plot, but in, I suppose, the visual stylings of the film as well. But with the idea of an alternate reality happening and everyone else goes to sleep, but you stay awake, and then these aliens come and change reality around you. It's a fascinating film, and I certainly see where a lot of the similarities sort of come from. But I don't watch Matrix 4, just watch Dark City. You will be more entertained, trust me.
Here, Al, I remember you telling me an idea that you had. If you were in charge of a Matrix, you had mm-hmm. a particular part of a series that you would have wanted to see a film about. What was that?
Sometimes when you're watching a film, and the film will itself accidentally sort of stumble over itself, and in doing so, it'll give me an idea for what would be a better film that I'd rather watch than the film that I'm actually watching. So I take it, like, as we've all here seen Matrix 4, have we?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll remember the bit where, like, they've taken Neo out of the Matrix again, and they've taken him not to Zion. It's a new city this time. I don't know why they changed that. It kind of undermines the fight for Zion in the third film. But anyway, we're in a new city now, and they talk about, they do the exposition dump catch up. And during this exposition dump catch up sequence with a very old Niobe, they talk about a machine civil war. And they do a brief flashback to it of machines shooting at each other. I'm like, why aren't we watching this? That's so much more entertaining. Why aren't we watching this? But then that's such a better idea. If you had the bad robots, the Sentinels, the evil machines, are trying to forcibly, in dictatorship, hold people in the Matrix, but you have good machines fighting against them. Now, I mean, let's consider this. The machines need power. They need to put the humans into this Matrix pod systems in order to function. And presumably the bad ones are just forcing people in involuntarily. On the good side, the one fighting for humanity's freedom, with that, and the question there being, would you voluntarily put yourself into a position that the other side are forcing humans into? Would they voluntarily sacrifice your freedom and choice to help power these good machines fighting for you? When, in a weird way, you're doing the same thing that the villains are doing. That 2 minutes of The Matrix 4 had my brain sparking with all these ideas that I wanted. I wanted to watch the film that was not being presented to me at the time.
I completely agree with you. The thing is, having that sort of human element in there, having that sort of human drama in the movie, I think would have maybe pushed some of the sort of harder sci-fi bits a lot more. And if you felt like it was an emotional consequence of everything you were seeing. This idea of human drama that's fuel for the engines of the genre films, of course, brings us towards our feature presentation, the Cornetto trilogy. A whole trilogy that is joined up by particular thematic motifs, this idea of growing old disgracefully, this idea of not wanting to conform, but also wanting the sort of security of the sort of things you should be doing in life. You know that at some point the youthful adolescent must accept that to get by society, they have to join in and lose part of their individuality. And that thread that seems to run through all three films, I would say, makes it a more coherent trilogy than other ones, like the recent Star Wars ones, where you don't really have this kind of thematic cohesion going all the way through it. Basically, I think for what we have here isn't just three movies that you could stick on in a row and go, that works, you know, I have a good time with all three of them. I think what we're seeing is a trilogy where all the three films work individually, but combined, they do tell a really good story about coming of age. You guys agree with that?
Firstly, I would say thematically, I always thought the connective tissue was ice cream, being the Cornetto trilogy. But no, I do agree with you that these are certainly themes of taking on responsibility and getting older, and it shapes all three films in a different way, I would say. Very differently. I suppose we'll explore them more when we go through them each in more detail.
Yes. Firstly, we can come towards Shaun of the Dead, and if you excuse me using a quote from a different film to get in there, let's boo-boo.
Do you ever think that modern life is not for you? Do you do the same dead-end job every day? Is your love life dying on its feet?
To a wonderful mom.
Oh, have you ever felt that you're turning into a zombie? Maybe you're not alone.
She said.
Shaun of the Dead. Now, this was following up on the heels of Spaced. When Spaced came out, I was about 13 years old or something like that. At the time, a lot of the kind of jokes, a lot of the references, they went way over my head, you know, particularly all the sort of drug humour and things. But the thing that I really enjoyed about it was Spaced looked like no other sitcom. You know, Edgar Wright had such a cinematic style during this, something that was so different from all the sort of free wall style shows that we had, you know, comedy shows of laughter tracks and things. You know, Edgar Wright was like, ah, fuck that, you know, playing by my own rules here. So I think there's something sort of inevitable that he would go from the small screen to the big screen. Were you guys fans of Space?
I never saw it until maybe 10 years ago, roughly. I found the DVD box set for quite cheap, so I thought I'd give it a try. Because back then, I was, again, like you, maybe not quite old enough to appreciate it, but I would have probably been playing my PlayStation on a Friday night anyway, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, it was very good. I mean, all his hallmarks were there, the fast editing, the, you know, the humour. And it was very different to a lot of the other sitcoms I were on at the time. Because, you know, I did watch some of them. I was mainly a BBC Two guy, you know, Reeves and Mortimer, that sort of thing, rather than Channel 4. But yeah, it was wildly different. Very, very more into pop culture than a lot of the stuff That was on at the time. I vividly remember the episode where Life is mimicking his Resident Evil 2 playthrough. And obviously a lot of Star Wars references, especially the episode one episode. That was very funny. But yeah, I think that was probably, again, I came into this a bit later, but for its time period, I think it was probably the most ingrained in pop culture I've seen a British sitcom from that period. I don't think anything else pretty much came close to it.
Alistair, are you or were you a fan of Spaced?
I'm not sure I would say I was a fan of Spaced. I watched Spaced. I really enjoyed it. I remember it had Mark Heap playing the odd lodger. But my favourite role with him was as he was in Green Wing as Dr. Alan Statham. And so his performances were absolutely fantastic. And I think I was very late to the Spaced game as well, because I'd watched Green Wing. I heard that, he's the guy that was in Spaced. And then I watched Spaced. And so I'm doing very, very different roles. And it was obviously good to see Mark Heap appear briefly as one of the barmen in World's End.
Say,
admittedly, there's going to be a bit of overlap in this review. We're going to jump between films a bit, possibly. But it was good to see him there. And I think with Spaced, because it certainly missed the window now, but there was a massive outcry for give us season 3. Everyone wanted a third season, and it never happened. Whereas another one of my favourite sitcoms was Black Books, which did get a third season. Nobody seemed to care.
So, with Shaun of the Dead, opinions of this one, guys? Are you guys big fans of Shaun of the Dead?
Yeah, I probably watched it maybe a bit too obsessively back when it first came out on DVD. I remember at the time it came out approximately the same time as Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead remake. So yeah. I know within at least my social circle at the time, people confused it with a spoof of that, because I think that was around the same era you'd get like Scary Movie and Idiot Movie, all those movies where it was taking the piss out of whatever was popular at the time. Obviously, it's completely different. It's its own thing. If anything, it's an homage to Romero's Dawn of the Dead. I think it was just a complete coincidence that Snyder's remake was kicking it around at the same time. And that's one of my biggest memories of it. I remember watching the DVD pretty much on repeat. I'd even, I should probably watch a few more in general, but I'm not a big special features guy, but I would even rinse through those just because I needed more. But it was definitely something it wore out back in the day, to the point where I think up until watching it again for this podcast, I would probably only half pay attention, because watching it for this recording, whether it's age or whether it's just the fact I've been paying attention to it this time, there was a few things I picked up on that I thought, I'm noticing this now, whereas before I was seeing this sort of thing in, say, The World's End. But when I watched The World's End this time, as we'll discuss later, what I thought I saw in Simon Pegg's character for that one, I'm seeing more of in Shaun of the Dead. So whether it's the fact that, pretty much the same age as these characters now, and therefore we've got a bit more empathy, whereas back, nearly 20 years ago, it was just because it was a zombie film that I enjoyed it. I think age has made me appreciate it a little bit more.
Yeah, because I think with Shaun of the Dead, out of the three of them, I believe this was the only one where the genre elements came first, where they said, we're making a zombie film. And then started to build in the sort of romantic comedy angle, the kind of coming of age angle, whereas the other ones supposedly began as here's what the character's going to go through, and then they'd use the genre to kind of capture that. So it's sort of like with Hot Fuzz, I believe that it began as a sort of look at the idea of here's a British cop. This British cop's trying to live up to the American image of what a cop would be like, but then we're gonna put him into a kind of Bobby the Beat situation, and then from there it quite organically became this really big dumb action film. The World's End, I believe, was about began life as being a piece about going back to your hometown and just feeling, pun partially intended, alienated from the whole place. And then, you know, from there, the genre elements were built. Whereas I think with Shaun of the Dead, it seems a bit more of a high concept. Like, hey, what if we took a rom-com and we stuck in lots of zombies?
Yeah, the way it plays out is very different, especially for its time. Back then, I think I was pretty much getting to the peak of my interest in zombie films. I was super into the Romero films. I had all those on DVD. Anything I could get my hands on, I would consume it. And it just came at the perfect time for me. And just the setup of everything, the way this guy, he's basically a child in a man's body. He's thinks he can get by on doing everything he's done all the time. You know, his relationship with his parents, his friends, his girlfriend. And the main thing with Shaun of the Dead is this guy's got to grow up.
Yeah.
It's a yeah. film, but I would say a coming of middle age.
You get parts where, I mean, I felt, maybe I'm getting old myself, but I felt sorry for the flatmate. When they're both wearing caps and they're, you know, playing beats loudly until 4 a.m. And I also admire the guy's restraint because he waits until precisely 4 a.m. before tackling the two guys. Stop this. I have work tomorrow. And Simon Pegg's character is the halfway man between, Nick Frost and, what's the other guy's name?
It's Arnefovich.
Yeah, so he's the halfway man between the two. And you see that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, obviously, those are best mates. They have a better, the characters make each other laugh more on the one sense, but when people are saying he's holding you back, like that's the film doesn't do any work to disprove that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You empathize with that. He's got to move on from this guy, right? But this guy is just dragging him down. But at the same time, Ed is so sort of, he's likable, you know, you can see the allure of hanging out with this guy. Like when Sean's really depressed, he's been dumped by Liz, and Ed starts trying to cheer him up by doing his monkey impression. Right? Like, there's something almost quite funny about that scene. Right? Like, Ed basically has to die in the film. So, yeah, full spoilers for all three of you.
Yeah.
Ed basically has to die for Sean's maturity to be facilitated. Yeah. Because the film is basically saying that, what, like, your own laziness, this refusal to grow up, that is more of a threat than a whole load of zombies, right? The whole army of the undead. Because just like the other movies, it takes this really big life event to make the person change. In that respect, I think the banter with Nick Frost is just it's perfectly done. You know, it's that need to grow up, but that also kind of just loving this total idiot. It, as an audience member, it puts you in quite a strange position. You know, you're like, I want Sean to sort his life out, but I totally want to watch these guys just fuck around for the next hour and a half.
Well, I feel like I've kind of lived that to an extent. Like that scene in particular in the bedroom where they're, you know, got the electro and they're scratching the records. One of my best friends is a DJ, and we've been at his house after the pub. Records on loud, making a lot of noise, and his parents have had to come in and just basically bollockers. And watching it back then, I was like, yeah, I know what that's like. And watching it now, it's like, ah, so I was that much of a dickhead.
You can, as you're growing up, I suppose the film gives you, you can see it from both sides.
Yeah.
You want to have the fun, but then you're impeding on other people's life responsibilities.
There is I felt a lot of parallels from my formative experiences being shown on this, especially this time around. You know, I'm a few years older than when I've last watched it. And I guess I'm the more mature side of it now. And I'm looking at a lot of it thinking, well, that was just me 10 years ago.
Would it have been, because obviously we have Nick Frost's character, Ed, and he really wants to drive the car. But then when he learns that Simon Pegg's father has a, I believe it's a Jaguar.
Yeah.
He wants to drive that car. And so I'll just stay here, mind the car. And they go in, they have to see inside the house. They come back out. Car's crashed. Guess we'll have to take the Jag. And it's, like, you can see the cogs working in his head when he's planning out that scheme.
Oh, he's such an asshole. I love it.
He's a friend you'd love to hate.
Yeah, he's a total lovable goofball.
He's almost pure liability.
in a way that, like, so then we've got Daffy, Dil Moran's character, where so we've got the line about Di and Daffy. They refer to them as a failed actress and a twat. And fair play to Dil Moran, he plays such a good twat in this.
He does.
And I guess it's almost like a thing if you go, well, he represents maturity in this film, along with Peter Serafinowicz, and Nick Frost represents immaturity, and I like seeing Sean hang out with these guys more than I'd like to see him hang out with these guys. Like, with Daffy, he's also a bit of a liability as well, in that he's essentially just there as a low-level antagonist. You know, he's consistently kind of there to say that's a shit idea, almost like it's a barrier to be overcome for every major decision in the course of the movie. But like, I think this is where Sean is the most relatable protagonist. I like that, you know, his sort of London life is he wants to just hang out with Liz and have a good time, and this is what the people who have their shit together are meant to look like.
Yeah.
And you know, there's something quite poignant about the London setting as well, actually, where you've got this sort of the zombie horde going around that nobody notices because everybody's just going through the motions, you know.
This is in my notes, right? So I was watching the film. Now, how aware is Simon Pegg's character supposed to be about this? So what I mean by this is, like, Sean's, like, he's in the flower shop. He looks across a field to a man eating a pigeon, starting with the head. And he's looking at it like, that's weird. And then a bus zooms by and then it's all changed. And then there's a few other points where something about zombieism catches his attention. But then he gets up one day and he has a walk to the shop and a walk back from the shop with the cornet. And this is obviously the apocalypse has happened now. Everyone's dead. And he doesn't notice the bloodied handprint on the fridge in the shop. He slips on what we assume is some guts, and he throws change. Like, it's almost the same thing again, where he throws change at the man who asked for change the previous day, but he's dead now and doesn't care about financial reward. I thought that was good, but on the one hand, we have a character that's more observant than other characters in the story. But then he changes to the least observant character for that scene. It's a very funny scene, but it changes the observation levels of...
It's a play on one of the opening scenes, isn't it? We see him go to the convenience store across the road quite early on. It plays exactly that same route. He's, you know, trips over the curb on the way. It's the guy washing his car that he, you know, just ignores, walks past, walks in the shop, grabs a can of Coke, puts some money on the counter. We even see one of the zombies that we'll see later on, same attire, it's a guy in the wedding outfit. And again, like, it's all done in that one take style as well. That was pretty neat. Walks back.
Yeah, that's true.
And then we see that same routine again. So it's obviously something he does time and time again. So I think with his lack of observance for that one, I think it's more of an observational joke than anything.
It does seem to be
I took it as a visual metaphor for basically being bored. You know, so it's like you've got this job, you're doing the same job 5 days a week. In his case, you know, he's selling electronics, doesn't really care about it. You know, he's got the routine of go to the pub every night with his mate and so on. And, you know, maturity is always next week or whatever. But, you know, I think that's just it. It's just sort of like late 20s, early 30s kind of malaise. You're just a bit bored. You don't feel like you're putting your all into it. And that's the thing with Sean. He's basically living without really living. You know, he's a zombie.
I agree with what you're saying about the malaise. Think thematically and visually what they're trying to connect. Certainly in the opening credits of the film and at other points dotted throughout, are the links between how the dead behave and how the living behave and how it mirrors each other. And he also has the opening credits when doing the same motion over and over again, the girls at the checkout, the three men at the bus stop that all answer their phones at the same time, all with bored expressions on their face. And there's always that moment where there's Sean's obviously come out of bed and he's sort of shuffling along the corridor. The camera's down on the carpet, panning up, and it sees that he's yawning, you know, zombie-like. But he did it at the start of the film. But by doing it at the end of the film, are we supposed to take that he has learned nothing from this? But that those little moments of linking like the dead to the living and how, I don't know, death emulates life.
I guess on this point about does he really learn anything, like the ending bit of Nick Frost, it sort of struck me as a slightly, like, it's visually satisfying to see it. Don't get me wrong. It works as a nice little PS. But I also just took that as being almost like a kind of a, just a way of ending on a gag. I mean, if he has any development in it, I think it probably comes from his relationship with his parents. You know, we've got the bit where Bill Nye's all like, you know, I actually did love you. That part's quite nice. And then the most emotional
bit, his mum dies. Yeah, yeah.
Like when his mum dies, it generally is quite crushing. Because like she's kind of almost like the safety net for him here, you know? And he's not got that. He's now I suppose actually if there's a problem with the way the characterization is written in it, it feels a bit like all the other characters are there with their relationship being defined by what they mean to Sean. So you've got like the mum's there as his safety net, my dad's there as like his tough love who will eventually be like, oh, I think you're all right. You know, you've got the sort of silly best mate and the slightly shrewish girlfriend, right? And I think it's very much a movie about his transition into adulthood here, rather than them necessarily being characters in their own right. But I do think that where the drama works, it really does work.
Just whilst you were talking, because we started on mentioning about the mum character, the mother, and it strikes me in this film that if this was intended, it had to be subtextual. Is Nick Frost's character Ed supposed to fancy Barbara? Because
really never got that from him.
He makes the, I don't mean to be crude, but he makes the eating out joke when Simon comes home and says, did you get our phone messages? Oh yeah, this person called, that person called, and then your mother called asking if you wanted to go out, and then she called me to ask me if I wanted to eat her out. That being the gag right now. But later on, he gets very, like, he's very friendly with Barbara. He's like, hello, Barbara. And he was protective of Barbara later on when it's the Mexican showdown between everyone. And it just got me wondering, like, is Nick Frost's character supposed to fancy Simon Pegg's mum? Because this technically links into The World's End as well, if you think about it.
I saw it more of just a camaraderie thing, because, I mean, the amount of times my friends have made a your mum joke, and then the bit later on where they're in the bar, I just saw it of him being protective of his best friend, really.
Yeah, but I mean, I think also maybe it does hint at a backing story, a bit like I'm thinking of Gavin and Stacey here, where with Smithy, you know, James Corden's character, it's quite clear from the way that he interacts with Gavin's mum that he's almost been like a second son.
Yeah.
You know, that he's come from like a clearly quite dysfunctional household and is probably round there all the time. And I guess with Sean here, maybe what we're doing with Ed is sort of, if Ed's having this sort of relationship with her, I think that your mad joke is just being a your mad joke, but with Ed sort of being invested in her, I'm wondering if that's maybe a way of emphasizing how long these guys have known each other.
That's true.
That could work. There's some really good foreshadowing of this. So you got the obvious bit when we're talking about, like, you know, the plan, like the drinks, the Bloody Marys, et cetera, et cetera. But then, something that I never noticed was, until this thing, was next time I see him, he's dead, which Ed says about the flatmate.
Yeah.
And in fact, during the, I think it's the same conversation, the flatmate says, go live in the shed, right? to Ed, you know, it's if you want to carry on acting like that, go live in the shed or whatever.
There's visual foreshadowing as well, because early on, you've got the flatmate, and he straightens the cabinet mirror in the bathroom and then sees him standing behind him, and they have a conversation moaning about Ed. But then they think, oh, he had a bite. Did he turn into a zombie? And they don't find him, but then obviously Simon goes up and then he straightens the cabinet door. He closes the cabinet door again. The mirror aligns to a shadow in the curtain behind them. And that's obviously, as we know now, the zombie. So I thought that was a very good bit of visual storytelling. But it had been so long since I'd seen the film that when he goes around to his girlfriend's place and they're like, don't come in, Sean, you're not welcome here, you're not wanted here. And then he threatened to climb up the side of the building. I distinctly remembered him climbing up the building. And then they all wait, they look at the window, but then the buzzer goes again and they let him in. But then I was sure he climbed up that side. But then later on in the film, that's what he actually does to save them from the zombies. It's like, oh, yeah, that was right. By the way, given that over that flat, you have his girlfriend, Kate Ashfield, that plays Liz, and Dylan Moran's character and Lucy Davis. Those three would have been better off not following Sean's plan because two of them did end up dead.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, they don't benefit from the whole thing.
No.
I really enjoyed the scene actually where he's going towards the flat. You've got this sort of long-held shot of him with the cricket bats because something that makes the zombie genre in the UK quite interesting is we don't have guns over here, right? So whereas in like Night of the Living Dead, it makes perfect sense they have ready access to firearms. They don't here, except for the gun behind the pub. The joke's got bullets in it. So my violence is all cricket bats and violence.
I need to touch on something here. This has been a bit of a sidetrack, but the health and safety in the Cornetto trilogy is absolutely appalling. One, we've got a live firearm in a pub open to the public. Two, the pub, I forget its name, but the pub in Hot Fuzz, they're having a shootout with the two owners at the end. One of them shoots, there's a bear trap affixed to the ceiling. The bear trap comes down, hits the guy in the head, and connects with his neck. That's a live activated bear trap hung in a position that could fall down and ensnare someone's head, which it does to the owner. That's dangerous. Like, the owner of that pub, they did not think that through. That's almost as bad as having a live firearm in the bar.
I like to think The World's End is the film that pays most attention to contemporary health and safety.
I'll tell you this, the bars themselves in World's End, all 12 of them, well, 11, let's be honest, are technically more safe than the Winchester and the quiet country pub in Hot Fuzz.
With this one, it was the shortest of the movies by a fair margin. I think it was also, it felt very well paced, but, and here's my main criticism of this film. The reason this is my least favourite movie is out of the three of them. And I do still think it's a good film. Don't get me wrong, we're going to go straight to the 4 stars for this one for me, but the reason that I don't like this as much as the others is it feels like a series of connected sketches almost. So you've got scenes that are like individual set pieces like, all right, here's a bit where we go through the vinyls and decide which ones to throw and we'll hit the zombies with.
That's a funny idea. Very brilliant scene.
Works well, but it's something they only do for that scene and they never mention it again. You know, it's the same with where we've got the bit where they're having to pretend to be zombies kind of shuffling like, ooh, right? And that's, again, it feels like a sketch, but it's a sketch that facilitates moving the plot on forward. The bit where they meet up with the other group and you've got this sort of smug little in gag about, oh, look, here's some recognisable faces on the other team. You know, that also felt like another, just a bit that they have here. And also when they chug Queen on the jukebox, you know, they all go in and start hitting the zombie with the cricket bats. It works, but it's just another thing that feels like a bit, a 2-3 minute bit before we move on to the next bit. And for me, Hot Fuzz and World's End feel like more satisfying narratives than that.
I'm going to disagree. I mean, I would say, I suppose in support of your point, I would say that the sitcom background to the writer and director shows in Shaun of the Dead, and you're doing what you got into the habit of doing something for a half hour, now triple that, but make the narrative last longer. But I think, I mean, the point of a joke is set up, payoff. And executes the comedy perfectly. And I actually really enjoy the comedy of this film because it's a comedy film with zombies in it. But at no point are we horrified. There are violent moments in the film. There's some melodramatic moments in the film as well. But I think, for me, Shaun of the Dead is the best. Like, there's a number of ways that you can make a movie. You could, like, maybe the direction failed or the actors succeeded or they got the cast wrong, but the direction was good. To me, this is like Tremors almost, which is another one of my favorite films. It's the best version of what it could be. If you got, you know, for instance, Kevin Bacon way out in the deserts of Nevada being chased by sandworms, ridiculous. But that film, Tremors, is the best version of itself. And I think that Shaun of the Dead falls into that same category of this is the best version of what a London-based early noughties zombie movie set in London could be. I don't know how you could actually improve on this film.
Where I'd agree with you on that is I do think this film is very funny. Despite what I was saying there, I do think this is a very funny film in its own right. I suppose there's maybe a sense of wanting to see more of a this happens, so this happens, so this happens, rather than a like this bit happens, then this bit happens, and this bit happens. But at the same time, this is absolutely set the template for zombie comedies, or like it sets the standard. I should say. Like every time a zombie comedy comes out, it will be compared to Shaun of the Dead, usually unfavorably compared to Shaun of the Dead.
Well, I think that's the case with most British comedies in general, isn't it, these days?
Well, I mean, things you've got like these movies like think of like Life After Beth or something like that, where they're perfectly passable zombie comedies, but it's a bit like when you've got The Exorcist, right? When The Exorcist comes out, and then you've got a sort of subgenre of exorcism films, and the thing is, we're always going to be compared to that one because it's the original, it's the first one, and it just does it so perfectly. Like, you know, whether you're watching something like The Last Exorcism or like The Devil Inside or something, we know roughly what it will look like because we've seen this.
I would argue that The Exorcist technically it surpasses its own sequels. It hit the entire genre of horror movies because there'll still be horror movies, I would say, next year or the year after, a horror movie's going to be released and someone's going to say it's even scarier than The Exorist. Like that quote will get bandied about year after year about...
Hereditary was the most recent comparison that people were making.
It's true. Yeah.
They're like... But I think with The Exorcist, you know, it's for the whole possession genre, it just is the possession genre. And, you know, Shaun of the Dead, for me, it's zombies and comedies. You almost shouldn't even bother trying because this film exists.
That's a very good point.
In that respect, they've done a wonderful job with that. And the way that I wouldn't say that about either of the others, you know, you can still do kind of self-aware action films in the post-Hot Fuzz era, and people aren't going to compare it to Hot Fuzz. You know, same thing for World's End. You can still do like a kind of sci-fi oriented comedy film or something, and people won't just say, "Oh, that's just like the World's End." But you do that with zombies. Shaun of the Dead is just the statement on zombie comedy films. So there was a name at least for a sequel. This is a great name. We're going to do a sequel to it about vampires called From Dusk Till Shaun.
I would actually quite like to see that if it ever happened.
That name alone is worth plunging $10 million into.
I'd love to see as many of the original cast as survived Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, I'll tell you what, I thought it was quite a good zombie comedy, actually. Now, one of the ones that I wouldn't directly compare to this, because it does play it a bit more seriously, was Dead Set. You know, the Charlie Hooker one.
Yes. That was the Big Brother.
I've seen that, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't quite as funny. You know, like Shaun of the Dead does have bits where it plays it straight. Like the pub invasion scene is played relatively straight.
I would say the comedy in Dead Set, that was dark humor.
Yeah, it's far, far darker than Shaun of the Dead. Like, far more violent. And, you know, with Dead Set, like you don't have a life affirming bit at the end.
Oh no, Dead Set goes from bad to worse. By the way, just while we're talking about ending, like going from bad to worse, there's obviously I mean, there's a happy ending to Shaun of the Dead, where he still gets to play video games with his best friend living in the shed. You just keep him in the shed. But here's my issue, right? So that it's literally respect for the dead. Like, even though these things are animated, they're up, these corpses are moving around. I mean, these used to be people with families. Would they still want... Because remember that when you get the montage of them playing these silly sort of games for their, like, tethered to a bungee rope running down a bouncy castle trying to catch cake or whatever.
Oh, yes.
These sort of... What am I looking for here? The funhouse style games that you would usually have on BBC. I don't want to get too personal on this. If anyone's lost anyone in their families, would you really want to see their animated corpses being used in this fashion?
Well,
I mean, that's really what happens in this universe.
Maybe it's a comment on, has anything really changed following this event?
Oh, that's deep.
You know, it's gone full circle. Yeah, this is that those TV shows that they're watching with all these zombies in is the same mindless shit they were watching at the beginning of the of the film.
Yeah, and I think also there's a bit where they have this goes to a sort of exploitation angle. You got the bits with the zombies. You've got them shoving around shopping carts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's right? Rafe Spall's character from the beginning of the film where he's working in an electronic shop on his phone.
Oh, I didn't realise it's the same guy. Aye, so...
I think he's the first one to say, you've got red on you.
Yeah.
Which is can I just say, that's just a strange way of phrasing that, which a number of other characters then repeat.
Yeah, it's a bit contrived when Ed says it later and he's covered in blood. I guess it's almost having it's almost like a meta joke how contrived it is, but without wanting to offend anybody listening to our show who pushes shopping trolleys around, the thing is that what they've chosen there for zombies is obviously like a manual job they've given them, and also a job that could be, to be honest, probably quite boring as well, right? And I guess that's sort of mimicking that when we see earlier on, you know, Shaun, who's in a job that doesn't inspire him at all, you know, he's stuck bored at work there. And yeah, I think Jim's right. The more things change, the more they stay the same here. There's always going to be people in that situation. It's just now it's sort of highlighting this level of exploitation. You know,
they've managed the zombie apocalypse. And when you say meta there, I would say it did go meta when I think Simon Pegg says zombie and then he's told not to use that word. It's like, Ed, don't say it. Don't say what? Don't say the Z word.
Yeah, at least he goes, it's stupid.
But I think they're ripping into zombie films that are maybe a bit head up arse that don't want to use the word zombie because they want to be a bit more sophisticated, but you are still just doing a zombie flick.
Yeah, so not a joke also about 28 Days Later, they talk about how this virus may have originated in a lab of experiment on animals, but that was later dismissed. I think there's something like that happens in the news report.
Can I just say that there was a great news report, was it destroy the brain, remove the head. They were giving instructions to people on how to stop the zombies. You have to destroy the brain or remove the head. And I remember the guy repeating it and just like, oh, I'd love to see that on the news.
I think that was one of the few times where Dawn of the Dead is homaged, because at the beginning of that film, you've got the, you know, panic going on in the news room and at the studio. You got the news report from the guy with the eye patch and all that, which again they're showing similar footage, you know, saying this is what you need to do to stop these things. So I think that's one of many subtle homages to Romero's films, along with David's death, where he gets basically pulled apart and they start chowing down on his insides.
That's the best. Can I just say this? You can tell when an actor corpses because he tries to look away from the camera. When he's out and all the zombies have his limbs, I'm still in Moran. I'm sure he tries to scream. And I'm sure he looks away from the camera because he's about to laugh as his character gets eviscerated. And I want to say this as well. This is one of those films where it looks like everybody involved was having a cracking time making this movie.
I was half expecting him to start shouting choke on him when he's getting his insides pulled out.
You know, I also think that for this genre, usually with zombie films, there are some exceptions, but usually with zombie films, it's usually used as a means like a sort of a vehicle of saying, look how bad humanity is, you know, look how rubbish humans are, and they have to try and share things, for instance. You know, it's kind of taking like the sort of Thomas Malthus idea of limited resources and lots of competition for limited resources, you know, the sort of survival of the fittest idea here. Now, like with this one, the zombie apocalypse ends up being quite inspiring. It's a kick up the arse that you don't need. Whereas, like, you know, Dawn of the Dead, it's like everyone's like, ah, oh, let's rob fuel and things. You know, it's all about exploitation.
It's usually framed in a way that the zombie apocalypse is happening and humanity deserved this. Whereas,
exactly.
You're right, the framing is different here,
It's very, very positive, very life affirming. And, you know, it's just that good little combination of different like genres, you know, buddy, rom-com, that kind of thing. I do think in some ways it's maybe the least thematically interesting of the three films, but that's also just because of how high a standard I think we see across them. I do kind of feel that maybe it's about trying to keep it quite light. The gags do kind of detract a little bit from any sense of threat in a way. It's very slapsticky, but I think you were right earlier when you said this is a comedy with zombies rather than a zombie film with comedy.
I just want to add, just to look at my notes, I want to add was there's a scene with Barbara, and when they're hopping through the fences, now that's another one of the recurring motifs in the Cornetto trilogy, but she spots someone that she recognizes in one of their, and this obviously is a setup to later on when they're in the Winchester. She pulls her sleeve back and shows that she got bit. And this is something I want to say about Shaun of the Dead that I do sort of personally appreciate. Because I think us in the UK get, you know, inundated with American movies, and sometimes it's quite nice to see a British one where this woman's been bitten in the wrist. She hid the wrist. It's like, why didn't you tell anyone? She's like, I didn't want to make a fuss. that's a British thing to say.
That's my mother-in-law in a nutshell, really.
She'll turn into a zombie, and she didn't want to make a fuss.
Oh, don't worry about me. It's fine.
And you're right, very, very British. It's sort of thing, I believe this film was quite successful in the States. There's a really nice anecdote where Edgar Wright was talking about watching this film with an American audience. And whenever we reach a bit of, do you want anything, you know, goes Cornetto, nobody would react to that. Yeah. But by the time he's watching The World's End, where the Cornetto rapper comes, comes in at the very end, he goes onto the fence, and the audience started laughing and applauding. Right? So he's like, you know, we taught the Americans something about ice cream.
Since you just mentioned it, I might as well say it now. I was going to say this, save this for my World's End review, but it's that of all the three Cornetto sort of cameos, if you will, or Cornetto, let's call it that, in each of the three films, The World's End's got my favourite.
Absolutely. I guess my favourite line from this film, it's immature, still very funny when he goes, I love her, guy. Like, oh, it's just like, yeah, that's teenage boy humor.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you guys reckon that this film could come out tomorrow? Like, is there anything in this that you would potentially get, that you potentially wouldn't be there anymore?
It's already been touched upon with regards to the childish homophobic language. I think Nick Frost and Simon Pegg actually mentioned it themselves recently, you know, how the film is somewhat dated, but that is the kind of language you got as a school kid, you know, and growing up in the 90s, I guess. Ed calling Sean gay for saying he's in love with Liz. Yeah, that is the exact reaction you would get from
the irony alone. It's just fun.
Exactly. I mean, I think the reason I reckon it kind of gets away with that is because it's put into the mouth of the stupidest character in the film, and also the character that Sean's got to outgrow as well. So, like, it's almost delegitimizes that. Anything else that potentially you wouldn't do if this film was coming out tomorrow?
There is obviously the mention of the N-word that Nick Frost... This is the point that he's sort of commandeered the Jaguar. He pulls the car up, opens the door, and he uses the word. And it's obviously not meant in a racist way, but it is used. It's meant as a pop culture reference rather than, I would say, anything negative. However, I just don't see that happening today.
Yeah, I don't think that would make it into a movie if it came out tomorrow. I think, I think, unlike the sort of homophobia element, where you could say, well, that's, you know, it's part of the, it's ingrained in the coming of age part, I think we would see that reaction as being so unlikable that the audience would have no sympathy with Ed.
I think it happened in the era where white people were trying to be cool and culturally trying to appropriate or emulate black culture. And that was one of the more ugly elements of it that has not aged well. With L.E.G., you're right, it was around about that time.
Yeah, because I think with comedy, where we have probably seen a bit of a shift is in terms of there's more of a concept of punching up, punching down now with comedy. Which I think back at that point, you know, it was maybe it's because it was a left wing government or something like that. But I think there was always this sort of assumption that everyone's got the same kind of liberal values, so you can almost do these sorts of things ironically. You know, I mean, with Ali G, I think where the joke was, the heart was in the right place. The joke was about him trying to appropriate a culture when he's actually some rich white boy from Staines.
But apparently it was an ad lib. He was, because he ad libs, and he was in front of a real police officer at the time, and he used the phrase, "Is it because I is black?" And the police officer, instead of tackling him on the ridiculousness of that, "No, you white boy, it's because you're in the way," the police officer just took him seriously on that statement, which added to the ludicrous, like, that's a whole other conversation, but it the ludicrousness escalated, and that just became a thing.
While I don't think you would make the Ali G show tomorrow, as such, I do. I think perhaps the intention was there in a way that I remember watching was one Grimsby, which, you know, it's an ugly film. You're watching this going, all right. So it's we're watching an Oxbridge graduate pretend to be a member of a working class.
Yeah,
just laugh at them, right? And you're like, maybe like 50 years ago this would have seemed cool, but now it just makes him look like a dick. So I think with Shaun of the Dead, you know, a few gags aside, I reckon this relatively timeless. I think it probably could. I think there probably would be, if it was released tomorrow, Liz would probably have a bit more to do. Or Die, I think she was underdeveloped. Potentially slightly, because I think they're very much playing to the sort of women are there to like kind of ruin the guy's fun.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with that. Again, there's so many rabbit holes we have in this conversation. Remember, I think it's Katherine Heigl that was discussing a movie she was in. I think it was called Grown Ups. She did
Knocked Up.
And she was referring to how often actresses are getting assigned roles where they have to essentially play a shrew to a fun-loving guy, and they have to try and make him grow up. But it doesn't... On the one hand, the female characters perhaps do have a very legitimate point, but it doesn't cast them in the best light. They're like a klaxon that's repeating grow up type thing. And Kate Ashfield's Liz is one of these characters, I think, that falls into that pitfall. It would be necessarily more agency, I suppose, in the film, because for the most part everyone sort of follows along with Sean's plan. Sean's plan, by the way, is shit, and he gets almost everyone killed. Just remember that when we're talking about this comedy. This is a comedy with a capital K. K for killed.
It's quite a good trajectory that we see as the series goes on, though, because I think Rosamund Pike's character in The World's End does kind of rectify some of that.
Yes, you know, oh, good show.
She's got a lot more agency in it. You know, she's got more personality. She's almost. She's generally more like
a double O agent. Can I just say, I love the reunion between her and James Bond, Pierce Brosnan. And they don't actually share a scene together, but they were both together in, I believe, the franchise's shittest entry.
Yes, absolutely. They'll die another day.
Mm.
That'll be why I don't remember that.
that was the thing that happened. As soon as I saw her, I knew, oh yeah, Pierce Brosnan's in this film as well. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But I liked having those two actors in the same film again.
I think with the point you're bringing about Catherine Hegel with Knocked Up, you know, I think she's basically right. I think at the same time, for a movie like Knocked Up, something I do quite like about Judd Apatow as a filmmaker is it seems that he's quite keen on improvisation on his set. So it means that while, don't be wrong, the role is a bit limited, the actors are also able to bring something from their own personalities to it. You know, so I'm not saying that makes it all better, but I do think that you get a bit more roundedness to the character than, say, the exact same thing happening in the Hangover series. You know, where it's the wife's like, you've got to be at the wedding. Oh, you've got to grow up. And the guy's like, yeah, we know. And of course, we're not going to because we get another two of these movies afterwards. Anyway, speaking of two of these movies afterwards, we're going to move on to our next one, which is Hot Fuzz.
Three people have died in a week.
Accidents happen all the time. What makes you think it was murder?
There hasn't been a murder in 20 years.
You're saying this wasn't an accident?
Not everyone's a murderous psychopath. It's high time you realise that. You and your monkey.
Did he mean me or that?
Have you ever watched Hot Fuzz. So, I reckon that this is going to be, on average, everyone's favourite movie of the night. I think it's this one that probably has the most fans overall. And it's easy to see why. This is a really good little action comedy film. I think it's smarter than Shaun of the Dead, and it's more visually impressive than Shaun of the Dead. It's got a more interesting set of characters than Shaun of the Dead. Basically, I think this is a step up. I'm not being that in the way it's dismissing Shaun, because it's a great first film. But I think this feels more like a better crafted, more honed kind of comedy film. I'll go into more of this in a moment, but Alistair, what do you reckon of Hot Fuzz?
This is, I would think, yeah, I'm going to agree, is my favourite of the Cornetto trilogy. This film's hilarious. There's so many things that I think you can go into this. Let's say if you're watching this in order, or in release order, you'd seen Shaun of the Dead, you can go into this film with expectations, and this film just finds a way to exceed those expectations and take it in directions that you weren't expecting. I think this is the only one of the three that's not got any, say, science fiction or supernatural elements to it. It's just straight up, it's an all human story. And to add any sort of fantastical elements to it would have been a detriment, because the story that they have in this one, it's so good. The casting, it's a way in that Simon Pegg's hanging out with some of his favourite actors and his best friends. So they casted out, they branched out a bit in the casting. And we get Jim Broadbent and Timothy Dalton making appearances in this film for very memorable performances.
Oh, God, yeah. Timothy Dalton, can we just touch on this immediately? This is my favourite performance in all three of the films. He is so fucking funny in this. It's not even hiding in plain sight, you know, where the guy so obviously did it, right? Like, if there's a twist at all, it's that he's not the only one.
This is the thing. He's it's the first scene where he appears, Simon Pegg's Nicholas Angel is jogging. And he just comes up sides along him, jogging with him, and he goes, I'm a slasher, lock me up. And then he's like joking, I'm a slasher of prices, chuckle. But as he's jogging away, he shouts back saying, catch me later. Timothy Dalton's character in this film is so obnoxiously villainous. It's almost flirting with the idea of breaking the fourth wall, looking directly into the camera and saying, I'm the villain.
I think he's like, nonsense, if one were to smash your video. And all sorts of secrets would tumble out. Like,
oh, yeah. There was another one where he said about the other guy who owns the eyesore house up on the hill overlooking the village. And he turns around to the cop and he says, he'll be in bits tomorrow.
I just thought a bit where he's doing like a toast, you know, to you know, celebrate
their demise. Oops, wrong wording.
Just every scene, the guy is definitely having so much fun in this role. Like,
he's a delight. And I would say Hot Fuzz, the film, is a highlight. But Timothy Dalton in this film is a highlight of highlights. He's an absolute delight in every single scene he's in. And I just want to point out one of the subtle ones where he doesn't quite have a line as such, but this is after the house is blown up. And he's driving past and he's playing loudly a song that features the lyrics, fire.
Yeah. Fire, bring you fire. And then he does Romeo and Juliet later on after.
Yes.
Where he makes explicit reference to the two people that have died. For like, you know, how do you know who they are? He's like, news travels fast. Like, fantastic.
He's fantastic in this film, yeah.
Jim, are you a fan of this movie?
Who wouldn't enjoy Hard Boiled by way of Midsummer Murders? it's definitely two different films, isn't it? It's, well, I guess it's got a lot of layers to it, really. But you know, at first glance, you've got this overachiever who's showing everyone up, so he's shipped off to somewhere where he can't be a pain. And then all of a sudden, we've got a kind of slasher/cult movie. And then following on from that revelation, we then have a John Woo inspired action extravaganza. There's lots to it. It's
quite a development and escalation. Yeah. I've not thought it in those terms, but you're right. It is. Yeah.
It's a transition that works because like they managed to work it into the character journey, which I guess is essentially or at least for Nick Angel they do it with Danny. I'm not entirely convinced by him turning into an action hero in the last act, but it makes sense that Nicholas Angel becomes even better than he already is. Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, you know, for him, it's, all right, you've got to stop being so by the book here, you know, you've got to just sort of embrace the sort of silly kick-assness of the cops. You know, like, I think why this film works so well is him and Danny basically change each other. It's not a case where Danny's weighing him down. You know, he needs Danny to be able to make him into an action hero. And Danny needs him to be able to, like, kind of, you know, stop being this lout, you know, to see that his dad's obviously crooked, you know, and to kind of take his life a bit more seriously. You know, I think that would work with Danny in a way that it wouldn't with Ed, where Ed's maybe a bit too much of a dick, right? Whereas with Danny, he's really lovable. You know, he's a really likable secondary character. In fact, actually, the bit where we think that Danny's betrayed him, that's a genuinely quite powerful moment.
Yeah, that's I suppose the literal stab in the heart, along with the metaphorical one that you see in the film.
Absolutely.
What I quite love about this film is, the first one, we have the zombie apocalypse. The second one, we have a subtle alien invasion. In this one, it's humans, stupid humans with very stupid motivations. What is it you didn't like about these people? Jugglers. Crusty jugglers. They have a dislike of jugglers, specifically of the crusty variety. And the human statue, the man with the great big bushy beard... you see what I mean? Motivation. Like, what I like is that when Nicholas Angel comes up with a theory linking all of the crimes together trying to pin it all on Simon Skinner, who, as we know, Timothy Dalton's guilty in this film, but he's trying to link it all back. And the theory he actually comes up with is much more plausible than what the theory actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the mystery element does work really well. Like, once you get the reveal that there's actually more than one of them behind it, you know, I think the clues have been there. It's been worked into the film pretty sensibly. And, you know, it feels like a genuinely quite good payoff. You know, it makes me sort of wonder if they could have also done like a, almost like a Miss Marple style mystery and still managed to deliver on that front, almost like Knives Out or something. But yeah, I think they do. I think that they do a really good job of building up the town as well. Like, more so than the World's End, I think the town in Hot Fuzz is characterized.
Yeah.
We get to know the locals there. You know, you see this sort of obvious contrast between his life and the bustling metropolis of London at the beginning, where he gets sacked because he's too good at his job.
I can say, because I think, I'll make no secret, I think The World's End is my perhaps least favourite of this tonight's trilogy. But having said that, they are all damn good films. It's three excellent films, and you try and pick a favourite one of them, you know. So, but with, I think with The World's End, you can't, there's no way you could have the same kind of community development, because in Hot Fuzz, you get the one supermarché, as Simon Skinner calls it, the church, there's the police station, and the pub. These are your, say, four main hallmarks, and obviously the pub also serves as that sort of hotel where, you know, Nicholas Angel is staying. Whereas in The World's End, it's 12 pubs, which is, that's, first of all, that's a big number, and they're all sharing screen time with each other, going from one to the other. Because I would challenge any of you now to remember exactly what happened in which of the bars.
Yeah, because the only thing I guess you could use to really link those in your memory is because the name of the pub roughly links to what happens in it, like the famous cock where he gets recognised, for instance. You know, the king's head where he bangs his head.
What about the two-headed dog, the mermaid, the beehive? Oh, what happens there?
Oh, is that not the mermaid? Is that not where they have the marmalade sandwich? The two-headed dog is the one where you've got the twins.
Thank you, David. I didn't even put that together until just then. The two-headed dog is where you met the twins.
Yeah, so they do all tie to them, but yeah, like I guess we're almost making a point also about the sort of ubiquity with a particular type of pub interior, though. Like, we're almost making the characterlessness of it into a bit of a laugh. But
back to Hot Fuzz.
I love the supporting cast in this one. Paddy Considine's a guy that I didn't even know could do comedy. But as one of the Andes, who used to do murder, murder, murder. You know, it's like, I guess you think it's a murder, don't you? Because you're so obsessed with murder. Like, all the way through, these guys are just totally fucking up the investigation, even to the point where it's so obvious that someone's killing people.
Right, I'll say this now. I've got this in my notes. And in Shaun of the Dead, we had the worst zombies because they were slow. Shaun manages to run through a crowd of them and not get caught. In this, we have the worst police. In the next film, we're going to have the worst bloody aliens. But in order for these films to function, the villains, so to speak, they really have to be phenomenally incompetent. And yeah, in this one, the police are their own worst enemy. The chief of police, Jim Broadbent, is one of the lead killers. He's part of, I mean, what is the group even called? The Illuminati? The Crusty Jugglers? what would you call them?
Isn't it the NWA?
We'll just call it the NWA, is that?
It's the Neighborhood Watch Association. I know there's...
Oh, yeah.
It is definitely that type of an organization where they're dictatorially overlooking imperiously on their neighbors and judging everything down to like a fine tooth comb.
It amuses me with the clear plot hole, which it points out and makes fun of, is that we're looking at a town with such a low crime rate, but such a high murder rate. Right? They think that all the deaths would presumably stop it from winning Town of the Year. But at the same time, because of how much it builds up this idea of this, kind of slightly Brexity, very sort of...
Well, I like to think they're poking fun at Midsummer Murders in this one.
Oh, no, they absolutely are. I think it makes for quite an immersive environment, and... it doesn't even matter how silly the plot twist is, because you just buy it, you know, it works. And I really like Jim Broadbent's character when he shifts so much, because, you know, we see him as, all right, he runs a police station with a password to the gun cupboard is 999, right? And where
David, I had that in my notes and I was looking forward to seeing it. Yeah, the code's 999.
And when you're doing drink driving, and then your punishment for this is you end up having to buy ice cream for everyone.
Hey, they didn't run out of Chunky Monkey for a month.
Yeah, I guess that's all necessity on Jim Broadbent's character's part, isn't it? He's obviously got himself an intentionally incompetent police force.
Yes.
So they, obviously aren't aware of what's going on. And it's only when Nicholas Angel appears that, the cracks start to show. Which, by the way, did you pick up on that the music supervisor from these films is Nick Angel?
No.
So I'm wondering if, it's got to be
that's not coincidence. Characters. Okay.
But the thing is, it also works so well for his character, this guy who's defined as being perfect.
Nick Angel.
I love at the beginning when you got the song Goody Two Shoes.
Yeah. the music selection is very on the nose in this, isn't it? It's great. Another thing that's just absolutely wild and out there is the fact that a village in the 21st century would have a police station. Or anywhere for that matter.
This is all pre-austerity. You know?
Yes.
I like we've got the recurring motif of the swan in it, right? And then at the end, they do the scene from Aliens and the shuttle thing where Spunkmeyer, who's in there. And then you've got Swan doing the exact
same
thing.
It's not a motif, that's a main character. Technically, the Swan apprehends the lead villain.
Oh, that bit where we're having a wee fight of a model village, it's like purposely like a Godzilla.
I want to say about this, right? So, this is where I said that if my brain's a bit jumbled, it's because I've seen these films, and to comment on one is to sort of insinuate to the other two. And I did mention about the bear trap that fell down and clamped down on the guy's head during the shootout in the pub. Now, we obviously have the church spire going up through Timothy Dalton's chin, which was very shocking and hilarious at the same time. When I first watched that, I was shocked and I burst out laughing, and I was laughing in shock. And I loved it. And then there's a scene later where, with the spire still, the model spire still up through his chin, he goes, "Ow, this really hurts." And you're like, "Yeah, it looks painful." But they obviously chop the spire off, and then he's getting moved out in a head brace. I absolutely love this film's absolute lack of due process. The man with his head in the bear trap, and Timothy Dalton with the church spire up through his chin, they don't clearly go to the hospital first. They get taken to the police station because during the montage of them booking everyone in, they're both in there. Timothy Dalton still got the spire through his chin, and the other guy still got the bear trap on his head.
And with the last act in it, I love the sheer amount of callbacks that you get. You know, where you get so many repeated lines, like the whole fascist
part. That was so good, yeah.
They just build up all these lines in the script that they can then just do a playback to. And we've got to mention Olivia Colman, right?
I've got a view on this, but only go, yeah.
Yeah, Oscar winner Olivia Colman. Right, so we're talking about things that you could you do it tomorrow? I absolutely think you could still have her character in it, because I enjoy that Nicholas Angel immediately tries to like go, hey, you know, she's a police officer, and she's like, not last time I checked. Like, I like it, she's totally in on the joke the entire way through it. Like, you got a bit where we're at the church fete, and you got the pig being Spiro, she's like, that's me last night.
Yeah, and she's stuck between two guys at the time as well.
Yeah, then like knocks over the person at the end of the wet floor thing, goes, you know, get him a bit of girl on girl. Like, it's some, like, it's so over the top.
She's not playing a character as much as she's playing a caricature. And I mean, she does get one good line where she says murder in that doubting way, and she's a great actress. She delivers it really well. But I would say, I think in today's climate, do think that character, you would either have to excise the character wholesale or fundamentally change what the character is.
I reckon you probably have. You could keep her if you had a second woman in the film.
Yeah, that's one of the things.
That's one thing we're lacking.
There's no other protagonist females in the film.
Total sausage fest. Yeah. But I did sort of think that for this sort of idea of institutionalized sexism in the police, it was quite funny that they make it so over the top, but also that, you know, Nicholas Angel is the forward-thinking, progressive metropolitan.
I suppose it
then gets corrected by her.
I suppose it does fall into the line of, like, go big or go home. And with her character, they went big.
Yeah, if it had been less over the top, in a roundabout way, it would have been a lot more offensive.
Interesting. Yes, I probably, because it's so over the top. The actress is in on the joke, the character is in on the joke, and being in on the joke ascribes the female character, I suppose, that level of agency. Like, she's chose this. Like, Nicholas Angel, wind your neck in. She's having a laugh as well, and often with some of those innuendos, she's the one that actually initiates it. She's playing a caricature, not a character. Whereas, I mean, let's move on to another one of my favourite comedians, who has almost nothing to do in this film, but it's just very nice seeing him in the film. This is, again, where I think Simon Pegg's just casting all his friends and actors he wants to act with. It's Bill Bailey, who's booking people in, who's obviously one of twins, and has both of different haircuts. One says no, one tells me nothing.
the cast members in this were just fantastic. Steve Coogan at the beginning, you know, you've got Bill Nye, you've got these two, and Martin Freeman. You've got these three. They're just there for two scenes.
Yes.
One at the beginning, one at the end.
They bookend the film nicely.
Yeah, and we've got the guy from Game of Thrones.
The Hound.
You know, he plays... you've got two guys. You've got the Hound. Yeah, and what's it called? The Red Wedding dude, you know, the old guy.
Oh, the farmer.
I know it, yeah. Walder Frey, yes. I know exactly what you mean.
Walder Frey, that's the one. Yeah.
Dug someone's.
Found him.
Yeah, hired. Who, by the way, he also appears in The World's End.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of recurring actors, isn't there, over the course of the three films.
I think the only one, I could be wrong of this, but aside from the lead two, I think the only one that appears in all three is Bill Nye, because he's the voice of the voice of the aliens in World's End.
Rafe Spall, he's in all three. Is Martin Freeman as well. He's in Shaun of the Dead mirror group of friends.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. You've got him on the side of Jessica Hines and so you've got Reese Shearsmith there as well.
You're thinking of Rory McCann, who's the Hound in Game of Thrones, and he's the Yarp guy.
He's quality. Probably, if you're making this tomorrow, you probably wouldn't have a character's mentally handicapped to make him super strong. That probably wouldn't happen. But at the same time, I think it's also kind of making fun of just like sort of
the genre of movies.
Just the tropes.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like a country people are weird, aren't they, sort of gag too. I think this is probably the funniest out of the three of them, and it's the one that I think is most rewarding when you watch it again. I think with the character journey in it, I really enjoy the pub scene, you know, where Ed asks into the pub and they do go along, right? You've got what's quite a nice bonding bit, you know, where Simon Pegg's character, Nicholas, he's, you know, it's rewarding to see him getting pissed because he's such a stick-up-the-arse guy until this point of the movie. And I think also the way that those two bond, you know, they start off with Danny obviously likes him from the get-go, but Nicholas thinks Danny's a waster. But I think it's actually quite organic when we watch him get closer. You know, if in Shaun of the Dead, you like Ed despite his role in Shaun's life. In this one, we want to see Nicholas become sillier. Whereas in Shaun of the Dead, we want to see Shaun grow up. So it's really nice sort of seeing the two of them become friendly. Like I like the bit where you know, he mentions that he was trying to get the peace lily for Danny's birthday. That clearly means something to Danny in it. Yeah. You know, like moments like that, it gives it a heart, because Nicholas, out of the three protagonists, Nicholas is the least relatable one.
Oh, but definitely.
That gives it a heart.
Yeah, you see them chipping away at each other throughout the film, don't you? They get more and more attached, and but I guess because they're working together all the time as well, they get to see a bit more of each other, and it is fun watching Nicholas open up himself to, I guess, what would be Danny's regular guy. He kind of comes down off that pedestal of perfect person and integrates himself a little bit more, and it is good to see that unfold.
I really like this sort of lover's quarrel they give them. You know, where at the beginning you've got Kate Blanchett having her cameo, where she's like, you know, you're always married to a job and stuff. Or the Force, which we don't
like. That was a
Force.
Very funny scene.
they kind of redo that later, where it's Danny, and he's got this giant monkey, right? And he's going like, she's right, you're married to the Force, where everything like, runs off into the rain.
that's brilliant, that bit where they've cordoned off the church, that they're all in the rain outfits because it's pissing it down outside, and Danny's still got his little cowboy hat on, but with the rain protector on it as well.
Yeah. But one of the Andes calls him a monkey, and he's like, did he mean me or that? And then he lifts the monkey head into view of the camera shot. And it's so funny when he's running off. That's just a very funny shot all by itself.
Wait, something that makes me really quite like Simon Pegg here, is like, or what makes me think, assume he'd be quite a sound guy, is you think of all the funniest bits in this film, and none of the best lines are his. You know, Nicholas Angel is not the funniest character. I think in Shaun of the Dead, it didn't really feel like an ensemble thing, because everyone's defined by the relationship to him, but with this, most of the comedy is other people. Like, the other, like I think, you know, Danny, Simon Skinner, they have the best bits in it, you know, like Jim Broadbent's character feels really rounded.
If you hadn't...
Like, it's not the Simon Pegg show.
If you haven't seen this film, right, and you're going in to watch this film, and you know it's a Simon Pegg film, you know Timothy Dalton's in it, one's got a career doing sitcom and the other one was formerly Bond. What a surprise it's going to be to learn that Timothy Dalton's going to be the one with all the funny lines in it. Like, that's counterintuitive. And I think that's something else that was a pleasant, I suppose, surprise about the film, where Timothy Dalton can do comedy and he can do it really, really well. I'm sure there'll be debates online as to who's the best Bond is. I personally quite enjoyed Timothy Dalton's entry into the series. But he's a damn fine comedic actor. And he's perhaps possibly underused in that sense. It's maybe time for a sort of Leslie Nielsen-style career trajectory where he should do more comedy.
Oh, absolutely. Frankly, Timothy Dalton, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, you should do more comedy. If there's anything in this that doesn't quite work for me, it's for the character stuff. I mentioned this earlier, I just want to kind of reiterate the argument. With Danny, there's a good arc in that when he learns to stop being like, you know, just going along with what his dad says. He learns a bit of independence, and he basically learns to grow up. I really like that. I really like his sense of betrayal and hurt about his dad. And with him bringing the bad boys to a bit from shooting into the air, he can't do it. But I also kind of wish he was a slightly shitter action hero, because that sort of pulls you out of it. Like, when you've got Simon Pegg embracing his kind of inner action hero, it makes sense because the character has been depicted as just, like, perfect. Right? It's like he's holding himself back from doing this. Whereas with Danny, like, I like that he joins him in all the action scenes. It's a really good bit, almost like a sort of Han Solo moment in New Hope when he comes along, you know, to help out and stuff at the end. I just wish he was slightly worse at it, because suddenly he's able to, like, dive through the air shooting. Whereas I could buy that he would do it, but I could buy he could try it, but I think he would miss every single shot.
Well, when you watch the gunplay in this film, everyone's a terrible shot. Because we don't want to do... Nobody actually gets killed at the shootout. By the way, can I just say, it was funny when the priest... father, I forget his name, he comes out and then he has these miniature guns that spring out into his hands and he tries to shoot, but then he gets shot at the shoulder, and as he's falling to the ground, he goes, Jesus Christ. I was so satisfying. That was so funny. But I think Nicholas Angel's part, there's a part in the final showdown that was a bit that I didn't quite like, where he's hiding behind the water feature. And then directly behind him, a few windows up, there's a woman shooting at him with a semi-automatic weapon. And Simon Pegg whistles, and all these kids run into the shop and hear the bing-bong with each kid going in. And then you see the woman being pulled back from, like, they've taken care of her. And, like, nice work, Nicholas Angel. You just endangered a whole bunch of children with a woman who has a firearm and is evidently not afraid to use it. That's the only bit I'm a bit about.
It was a massive rifle, so she'd have probably been more dangerous with the other side of it than shooting the kids.
You're not wrong. She missed every single shot, but then so did every other character. Like, for instance, there's a woman. Do you remember the Country Lane? There's a woman with a double barrel shotgun who, like, misses.
That's a great callback bit again, because earlier they're talking to the Andes, aren't they? And so, well, everyone and his mother in this village has got a gun. And then it's the farmer the guy who played Dr. Chenard in Hellraiser 2. He sees.
Wait, Nicholas, are you kidding? Was that seriously Dr. Chenard in Hellraiser 2?
Yeah.
I didn't recognize him.
Yeah, and the guy who's the priest was Belloc in Raiders.
Oh shit!
So I got a few bit of a rogues gallery for the buildings.
I think I just need to watch Hot Fuzz again to catch Dr. Chenard.
Like, he sees Nicholas Angel in the car, and he goes, "Mom," and that's the woman with the shotgun.
Oh, can we talk about some of the deaths in this? Because, like, where I mentioned that I thought this is a big step up from Shaun of the Dead, just in terms of, like, technically, and also in terms of its ambition. One of the other ways is, like, Shaun of the Dead looked great, but this just, the deaths are so good. Like, we got the church spire falling on the guy's head. Like, you know, some really funny just bits of gunplay.
That's why I'm convinced that the church spire falling down and impaling on the man's head, I think the man in the cloak at that point had to have been Timothy Dalton, because later on in the film it's a church spire that goes up through his head.
Yes.
And before that, there's a bit of foreshadowing where they've all got their little stalls for amusements. And Timothy Dalton's amusement was Splat the Rat, where he had a bat on and he kept slapping it going, Splat the Rat.
Oh, that build-up, that entire sequence was brilliant. Because you've got that Tombola or Raffle, whatever it is, and draws out the first name. Tim Messenger. Oh, he's not there. And, like, we know he's got to meet Nicholas Angel. He's got information for him. And then the next name, Simon Skinner. Oh, he's gone to the toilet. And it's like, yeah, you see the cog starting to whirl. And then that's where we get the bit of the spire being pushed off. Just that whole build-up there was brilliantly done.
It's a great scene. It's a cracking scene.
In terms of what we're seeing from Simon Pegg as the lead, it's good to sort of see him go from being such a kind of slacker everyman in the first film to basically being this like superhuman cop.
Oh, it's a very different character.
Like, it's very different performance. You know, he obviously got very fit for the role and stuff. He plays the straight part so well. And, like, you know, you're looking at such a, like, it's basically the opposite trajectory that he's on. You know, Sean needs to grow up. This guy needs to stop, like, taking himself so seriously because he's socially inept. You know, it's only after he kind of lets his hair down again that he starts becoming mates with the people at the station and things like that. I think the sort of the rural versus urban subtext in there, you know, we've got this sort of this idea of this guy coming from a big city to try and change how everything's run. I think they work that in quite organically. The way that they, at the end, sort of imply, if this is a bit like Shaun of the Dead, actually, if we handled the zombies, this isn't really better here. Because, you know, you've got, okay, so the town, we know we're like, all right, well, fucking, like, jugglers and stuff like that. At the very end of this one, you know, you've got Nicholas, you've got some hippies out there, you know, strap on the jackets, let's roll, go out to get them. So we're like, all right, well, it's basically replaced what seems like one kind of pretty grim regime with another here, or potentially another one. You know, I mean, the film doesn't really have a, it's not, a, in terms, I don't think it's trying to make a much of a statement about policing here at all, but to the extent that it is engaging with the police, it's not trying to push a rehabilitation message by any stretch of imagination here. it's very much like, you know, this is a guy from a London Met, a police force that's well known for being quite brutal, institutionally racist, so on and so on, right? We're putting him in towards the countryside where people have really backwards ideas in the film. You know, like, it's depicting it doesn't have the thing of the big city cop comes along and, like, cleans the place up and makes it civilized or anything like that. Quite the opposite. He goes along and he realizes he quite likes it there.
But it's also he has to learn about the countryside, about this different way of life and this different, I suppose a different culture away.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I love the reference when he says, by the power of Grayskull, when he sees that entire shed full to the brim of weapons. That was a really good scene. And that's obviously a setup for later on when he, dons a lot of weapons to get through all the gunfights he needs to in the finale.
We also get the power of Grayskull when we see Ed.
I would say that's the setup for it. Because Nick Frost says it, and then later on we've got Simon Pegg saying it. Oh, and that sort of showing that they're rubbing off on each other in the power of Grayskull sequence, or setup and payoff. And obviously you get the ultimate shoot down at the end, which it's a very British gunfight as well.
Yeah, I would say it's so absurd as well, the fact that you've got all these middle-aged people that, you know, you would expect to be quite pacifistic just suddenly start packing heat. You know, they've got bloody submachine guns and pistols and all sorts, and all of a sudden you've got one of the best filmed shootouts in pretty much any film I'd seen from that era, and it's all in like a village square. It's all people over 50.
A really mundane sort of setting. Everyone's over 50. People are shooting. Like, there's someone. Those bikes, the old bicycles with a massive front wheel but a tiny back wheel.
No, the penny farthing.
The penny farthing. Like, I almost expect someone to show up on that wielding an AK-47. Like, that's a sort of anachronistic fight that we have going on in the finale.
And it's just so well choreographed as well. I would go as far as to say it's the best gun, the best shootout I've seen in a film at that point since Heat. That's but it's so absurd you know, who's involved in it. It's just unreal.
I just want to make a very quick comment about the editing and the shot composition. And when we get to the pub and the shootout happens there, but the rest of the police reinforce Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, Jim Broadbent presents himself at the end of the hall in almost a Mexican standoff type manner. And in anger, he shoots the sort of candlelit chandelier that falls down. And when it falls down, it goes slow-mo, and he's got his glasses on, and the lights reflect off his eyes, and he's doing a kind of roar. And the sound effect that they're using in this is a lion's roar as he turns around to run away, just purely for effect. And I thought, that's not what happened, but it's very artistic and poetic, and I really quite like it.
Has anyone got a favourite gag in this film?
God, all of them. Everything Timothy Dalton said.
The sheer amount of callbacks in this, we've already touched upon it a couple of times, but if there's any little bit of dialogue in the first quarter of the film, it's turning up at the end. Like, you know, you've got them talking to the Andes. Like, do you want us to go through the phone book? We'll start at Aaron Aronson. And then at the end, a kid in the model village. Mm. What's your name, kid? Aaron Aronson. And he just look on his face.
When we're at the first bit where he's walking through the village, you've got one of the villagers saying, check out his arse, right? And later on, you've got the same villager saying, check out his horse. Like, little bits like that were just very rewarding.
Is that the same shot where the woman says, so no luck catching those swans then, or it's just the one swan actually? But then later on she says, no luck catching them killers then. Is it just the one killer actually? She's the idiot that buggers up. And then the penny drops. It's not, okay, it is Timothy Dalton, but it's also a lot of other people as well.
I like the editing during the murders as well, the way it intercuts between what other people are doing as well. So, like when they're in the pub, for example, guy's name.
So it's sort of a juxtaposition style of editing. Yeah. I think Edgar Wright's made for doing that type of editing.
Because, they drop him off at his house, at that big mansion, don't they? They go back to Danny's place and watch a couple of action films, but it keeps cutting between him and them. And at some point, it kind of mixes it up a bit, so you can't quite tell who we're looking at first. And it's the way it's edited together is so clever. It works really well.
Does anyone here get Scream vibes, or certainly Ghostface vibes, off of the hooded figure in this film? Like, it was all there, just a part, not quite the ghost face itself, because obviously plagiarism, Scream, but, you know, the hooded figure is still that sort of...
Well, it goes back to that Timothy Dalton gag when we're first introduced, doesn't it? You know, I'm a slasher, I need to be locked up.
Do you remember just right before he gets church spire up through his chin, he's running at Simon Pegg, but he's pulled out a box cutter. He's pushing the thing up so the blade pops out, but it's only out by like an inch. And this is the least threatening whiz. In real life, I'm sure a box cutter would do a lot of damage to a person, but nothing a few stitches couldn't handle. But it's the least threatening weapon that you could have had. I'm now thinking, was there a significance to the vehicle, the toy vehicle that he stood on and slipped on? I couldn't remember what it was.
It's not one of his own vans.
Yeah, it's one of his own vans, and obviously the box cutter, because he's a supermarket manager. Mm-hmm.
I love it because he's also the one that gets to say the title, not quite the title of the film, this Hot Fuzz, but when the police are approaching the supermarché, he's looking into the CCTV going, here come the fuzz. Like, he's reveling the competition, the fight. He's almost the Joker in this film.
Basically, this one is a very, very good movie. What star rating are we all going to give this one? I think this one might be a 5.
I'm not giving it any less than a 5.
What about you, Jim? Are you going to join us on side five?
I guess I should, but solely because I've watched this so many times, I've probably worn it out for myself. I would, at the time of watching it last time, I would have given it a 4.
Oh, I never asked you guys, though. What would you say for Shaun of the Dead? Like, because I give that a 4, so this for me is a step up. Do you guys on the 4 side for Shaun of the Dead?
Yeah, I'm solid 4 for that one, definitely.
Completely agree. Definitely solid 4.
Hey, now let's go to probably the least beloved out of these films. We're going to go to the World's End.
I saw the boys the other day. We're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
5 guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints. 60 pints.
Oh, steady on, you Alky.
This is our chance to finally finish what we started.
No.
We are going to do the Golden Mile, and this time we are going to see it through to the bitter end. Or lager end.
Good evening, Raymond.
The World's End. So, I don't know about you guys, this is my personal favourite out of the series. It isn't the funniest one, that's clearly Hot Fuzz. But I think it's the most thematically interesting in this. Like, I really love that Simon Pegg is playing such a piece of shit in it, right? You know, like, Gary King in it. The sort of idea of never having grown up, you know, he peaked at high school. You know, he's obviously not where he wants to be. He's kind of still reflecting on that. You know, he's trying to reclaim his old life. There's just something so tragic about this. You know, the idea that the phrase, the past is a different country, you can't ever go back. Like the bit where he's talking about, you know, the young optimism, but feeling that we can take on the whole universe. And it was a big lie, right? And as a kind of way of rounding off the series, you know, if the other ones have been about growing up, and this is about the danger of not growing up. You know, this is about being stuck in your own nostalgia, basically. And for me, it's the most interesting of the films. It's got the most layers to it, and I think it's basically the most mature. I absolutely fucking love The World's End, and it gets better with every viewing. Now, I know Alistair said this was his least favourite of that. We'll come to our favourite films. We'll come to that in 2 seconds.
True story.
Jim, what about you? Where do you stand at The World's End?
It's a weird one, isn't it? It's not the most obviously funny out of the three of them. And definitely, thematically, it's the deepest. You could say it shares a lot of parallels with Shaun of the Dead, particularly the whole needing to grow up and, you know, you realize you're an adult. But this one definitely has a lot more layers to it in terms of, you know, how and why. I would say it's as good as Shaun of the Dead. I prior to watching it for recording, I would have said that to me, this was lamenting growing up. Like, you're missing the good old days, going around the pubs with your pals, getting up to no good and not having any consequences. But then I kind of saw that in Shaun of the Dead as well. And from a thematic point of view, that's more prevalent in Shaun. Whereas this one, as you've said and touched upon already, is that it's the dangers of not growing up from the get-go. I mean, Shaun of the Dead, he's clearly an adult and functioning anyway. He's just got to get his shit together. But in this one, we've got Gary King, who has never been functioning in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, we can see he's clearly got addiction problems. He's depressed. He's living in, probably an institution from what we can see from the beginning. And dragging all of his friends back together just so he can feel anything, really, just a remote bit of joy, just to recapture some of that, you know, good old days, it cuts quite deep.
Is someone who, like, in a normal friendship, say, you go to some effort, let's say you and your friend, you go 50-50, you meet each other halfway, and Gary King kind of strikes me as the kind of person that will go 20% of the way and expect everyone else to do 80% of the work. He's certainly by far my least favorite character, but if I'm being fair about The World's End, I think that of the Cornetto trilogy, it certainly didn't live up to my expectations. based on the previous two films, and those are massive shoes to fill. But it felt like this one was less of a comedy, but it probably had more to say.
I think that's absolutely fair. It's got sort of like a bit of a love-hate relationship with Pasternak. So I think, you know, you're right, Jim, that there's an element of you get older and you kind of miss being able to sort of arse around and things. Like, there's a bit where he says to them, like, words to the effect of, you envy me because I've got the freedom to do whatever I want, right? And there is a bit of that in the film, because we know that none of them are leading amazing lives here. There's a sense of wanting to just kind of live it up again. We see them in their adult lives. At the beginning, you've got that nice montage where it's going through all the houses. And you've got Simon Pegg's, like, the one who's not going off to work, and he's the one who's not, like, sat down at the breakfast table and so on. And I think maybe it is sort of, there maybe is a sense of, we miss that point in our lives. And, you know, I'm sure all of us can identify with this, you know, when you're, like, say you're in a stag do or something like that, right? And there's something quite fun about just sort of behaving like people half your age again, right? I think it really taps into that. But at the same time, it's quite poignant that Simon Pegg was an alcoholic at the time, a recovering alcoholic at the time they were making this film. And he wasn't public about his alcoholism at this point. Clearly, like, they handle the subject with an element of sensitivity as an audience. I think this is what makes Gary quite interesting as a protagonist. As an audience, we have a better insight into what's going on with him than he does himself. And, like, you know, the bit where we see the sheer extent of his demons, you got the scene at the end in the world, or not quite the end, but towards the end of the World's End pub, you know, it's the, you know, it's all I've got, where we see the marks and stuff like that. Yeah, it's really hard hitting. You know, but maybe part of it is in the hindsight, knowing that these were probably very real emotions there. And also knowing that we have two real life best friends who are acting out this scene, but perhaps resembles a real conversation they will have had at some point. I don't know. But I think it gives it that layer of emotional authenticity to the whole thing. Like, this guy is a prick, don't get me wrong. And he should be everyone's least favourite of the protagonists.
Oh, yeah.
He's so sad as well. Like, that redeems him for me. Like, you know, it makes him more than just the famous cock in the film. You know, he's also he is also tragic.
He's almost Ed from Shaun of the Dead, essentially. And I find with Gary King is that, I mean, you could say someone can be like an aspiration, inspiring influence to the circle of people around them. They can, like, lift them up and raise them. And it's just dragging everyone down. I mean, he's got one of his friends, he's got the Beast, the car, and he's getting points on the car. Basically, the car is in his friend's name, his quote unquote friends, you know. Mm-hmm. So didn't you wonder where all those points came from? And he lied about his mum having cancer to manipulate Nick Frost into going on a pub crawl with him. Like, I mean, for instance, Dave, can you imagine if I came to you and said, like, mate, my mum's got cancer, let's go on a pub crawl. What's your response to that? I mean, that is fiendish. That is
absolutely,
that is ghoulish behaviour.
Yeah, he's an absolute manipulator in it. And the thing is, first time I watched the movie, I took at face value that his mum had died. So
were you not angry when you found out that she was still alive?
Exactly, I was. Yeah. I had that same feeling of betrayal. I was like, fuck you, I give you the benefit of the doubt, just like Nick Frost has done here. And they got that nice line where he says, well, we're not your friends, we're your enablers here. You know, he is just taking these guys for a ride, basically. But, yeah, for whatever reason, you just can't quite hate him. Maybe it's because you've got because of the actor.
I do.
I think actually this is actually another good thing about why Simon Pegg's will be quite sound in real life. Is I like that he, you know, he was a straight man in the previous one.
Yeah.
And now he's not. He's the
Gary King's complete opposite of Nicholas Angel. Nicholas Angel would have locked up Gary King and thrown away the key.
Absolutely.
So. Whereas Nicholas Angel might have respected Sean for surviving the zombie apocalypse in a way that he wouldn't have respected. Look, Gary King's full-blown liability to the point where this is a film where we could talk about all of the film and barely even touch on the aliens. The aliens do the was it the Day the Earth Stood Still thing, where you EMP the entire planet and then nothing works. So for his night out, Gary King rejects the aliens, doesn't negotiate with them, just outright rejects them. Classic Brexit negotiations. The aliens eventually just straight up give up. They leave. They electromagnetic pulse the planet Earth. If you think about it, everyone in the hospital, everyone needing some machinery to sustain their lives, or everyone in a plane, or anything like that, they're dead. They're just straight up dead. So Gary King's directly responsible for an unimaginable level of life ending all of a sudden in a way that I'm sure the zombies in Shaun of the Dead didn't even accomplish. Not only that, at the end of the film, he doesn't even hang out with his best friend, Nick Frost. He abandons his friends to hang out with their younger doppelgangers to start raiding other bars. Even worse, he goes into these bars asking for five waters. There are so many levels to the, and I'm going to call it douchebaggery. And the longer I get to know Gary King, the more I hate him. Also, black hair dye on a ginger head of hair? Question mark.
I mean, I like that it's clearly supposed to be dyed, but like it's almost acknowledging it. Yeah, because it's acknowledging how sort of stupid
it's like. But is it supposed to be dyed with the... Because they got an actor who is a younger version of Gary King, who I think actually has black hair.
Well, in both eras, he is obviously a goth. You know, he's got his Sisters of Mercy t-shirt, his big boots and leather jacket. So it's probably all part of the look, isn't it?
Yeah, I took it as he's always been dyeing his hair. It just looks sadder now.
That does actually add something to the character, a layer.
There is a bit of, you know, in the plot, Oliver, Martin Freeman's character, his birthmark goes because they replace him with a DNA replicant. Sorry, his birthmark reappears because they replace him with a replica of his DNA. So therefore, Gary King's natural hair would be on his head rather than dyed. So yeah, either or, swings around about.
Well, I mean, that would imply that the black hair was real. Mm. Whereas, I mean, let's be honest here, it's not.
Let's put it down to aging. Just for men.
It's just for men on a genetic level.
You could look at it, though, that they also had, keep in mind that they designed the clone to look perfect to him, to meant to look like his the happiest days of his life. One of the things that I reckon to detracted from the comedy was there was a couple of jokes that they repeated over and over again, and sometimes this works. In the case of Martin Freeman speaking in tech speak, I didn't think it was funny first time. I didn't think it was funny as it went on. Samantha, with her repeated phrase of "oh crumbs" over and over again in the film as well, that also kind of irritated me. And it's a shame because this is a series where repetition is often like a source of amusement. Oh, something we mentioned earlier was about pub names. So I've got a list of all the pub names from the film here, right? So,
okay.
In terms of their significant, the First Post, obvious because it's the first pub you go to. The Old Familiar, exactly the same as the First Post. Mm-hmm. That's your joke. The Famous Cock, where he gets recognised. The Cross Hands in that one. So this is a bit where they have the brawl, where they're crossing hands, I guess, with the baddies, is where you get the fight. The Good Companions, and they agree to team up with each other. The Trusty Servant, where they bump into the dealer, Reverend Green. Then we've got the Two-Headed Dog, which is the twins. Then we've got the Mermaid, so that's the Sirens, which is your marmalade sandwich. The Beehive is the Hive Mind, that's where you meet Pierce Brosnan. The King's Head, Gary hits his head on the way in. Hole in the Wall, drives the car through the wall. And the World's End. So it does work. All of these pub names. Wonderful bit of foreshadowing.
Falls through there. I'll touch on this right now. Because we had a former Bond actor in Timothy Dalton in Hot Fuzz, used to excellent effect, exceeds all expectations. And in this, we have Pierce Brosnan playing Guy Shepard. Woefully underused. He's in the opening montage, and then he appears in that one scene, and he's just woefully underused. And I felt that he could have offered this film so much more. You know, I think he really could have.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It just sort of felt like
stunt
casting. Pierce Brosnan, but he's not playing a part in it. Like, yeah, I think maybe there's a bit too many elements. Like, so you got in the Reese Shearsmith and the other dude, and you're like the two sort of Men in Black style characters, mm-hmm. and their role in it, they're there for no reason beyond a cameo. In fact, it doesn't make any sense that they're there at all, because presumably they could just kill them, and that would eliminate the entire problem in the movie from the baddies' perspective. So it's actually worse that they're there. But that's also underusing the actors. They're there for one scene and then leave. And I agree with Simon Skinner, that was perfect.
Yeah.
And this, just Pierce Brosnan.
I want to make a stray observation in this movie, where we get one of the friends who was bullied by this Chad-like character in his youth, and then he does get recognised, but then runs into him in the woods. They have the altercation. He has a fight and he starts beating up on his bully from school. I love the light, it feels great. And then he runs off. Now, this is the, let's say, the Fawlty Towers aspect to it. Because in Fawlty Towers, we get a scene where Basil Fawlty's in his car going mental because he's trying to get a duck back to the restaurant. Otherwise, one of his lies will fall through. And he starts screaming every single time. He gets out of the car. He starts wagging a finger at the car. Then he runs off. And then he runs back on screen. And he's got a branch. And he starts slapping the branch over the car. Now, when that guy starts slapping the bully with the branch, I was getting major Fawlty Towers vibes from that. And I just wonder if that scene was an homage.
It possibly was, just because of where you imagine that they did their sort of, supposed to be did their training, if you will, on sitcoms. You know, it's certainly quite a slapsticky British sort of vibe. I think, with all three of these films, so with the exception of Hot Fuzz, so when two of them, you don't have weapons. So there's something mm-hmm. quite fun about the improvisation style of, all right, well, what do we have?
A branch.
Big stick. Branch, yeah. You know, and it's cricket bats and vinyls in Shaun of the Dead. So one of the things that really works with this movie is the soundtrack. We've got the Beast, you've got this wonderful sad moment where it's exactly the same tape with the Prison Side. It's like, where'd you find it? It's like, the tape player. You know, there's one exception. As much as I love the song, Alabama song with the Doors shouldn't be in it. The reason it shouldn't be in it is because it's a song from a different era. Whereas the rest of the songs very much situated in the early 90s, the era that Simon Pegg's character just really wants to go back to. You know, you've got Primal Scream, we've got Suede, you know, we've got the I'm free to do what I want. Who does that song again?
I think is it the Soup Dragons?
Soup Dragons, that's the one, yeah. You know, it's a wonderful kind of lineup from that era. And, you know, when it does want to have something that hits you hard, you've got the This Is What It's Like to Be, Feels Like to Be Lonely, the Echo the Bunny Men one.
Spiral Carpets.
Fair enough. Angston, I can absolutely novice here. But yeah, point being, it's a wonderful soundtrack. I think it's the strongest out of them. Eliminate the Doors, because they don't fit the vibe, although it's a brilliant song in its own right.
It is.
And you have very, very good compilation CD.
There's a gag in it I did appreciate, which is the Ship of Theseus, where he talks about the Beast, that this car that still runs, I've just had to replace the engine, exhaust, the wheels, the gear stick, all the functional parts of the character have been replaced. Like, it's not the same car then, really, is it?
Oh, it's like Trigger's broom.
Yes,
horses.
Exactly that, yeah. And that's
Foreshadowing for the blanks, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I liked it. Can I say one of the cringy jokes about... it's when we're looking at the Beast, it's a scene where he's introduced to all the different parts. He goes, it's an antique. He goes, let's give us an antique on the roadshow. Nobody laughed.
I didn't laugh many times in this film, but one I did laugh at was the when he's speaking to his, I think, his former drug dealer, and he goes, "I am a robot," and he's doing the motions of the robot dance. A bit of slapstick, and I did laugh at that. Although technically, they're not robots.
True. I think with the humor, yeah, this is there are some individually very funny lines. I think like "You're drinking rain" is a really good line. But if someone said that they thought this is the most amusing, I would question that judgment.
Have they seen the previous two?
Yeah, it hasn't got the quotability of either of the other two.
No.
And yeah, and some of it is maybe a bit more of a sort of falling back on slightly lame gags, like I mentioned with the WTF thing, which we'd run into the ground. Although it is quite funny to see him say, "What the fuck does WTF mean?"
Admittedly, that I did find that quite funny. Actually, I quite like that. That was immediately after, I think, their first encounters with the blanks, which are totally filled up with bits of plastic and ink.
Let's talk about the blanks, because you mentioned earlier, Al, that this is a sort of movie that you could talk about for ages without really touching on the alien.
Yeah, it kind of is.
I mean, obviously, with the blanks, it's a low-ish budget film, or at least compared to what, if they had American actors, for instance. At the same time, they give the blanks a really quite good aesthetic. Like, I love the kind of the use of blue throughout it, you know?
The coming out of the eyes and the mouth. I enjoy that bit, and there's a sort of police siren wail that happens there, which is a complete antithesis. You're on the other side of where you would have been in Hot Fuzz, for instance. But there's a few things that annoyed me in the film, right? So do you remember the work of art, the statue thing? That had the face and blue lights come out of that. And there's a bit where, I don't know if it's budgetary or what, but Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, they jump between two cars, and the stick-out legs of this statue walks by, but then it turns its head, so the camera gets a shot of this thing, and the audience can see this is also one of the alien blanks. But in doing so, this thing has clearly already looked directly at Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and then decided to just turn its head the other way and carry on in that direction. This is why I say these are the worst aliens. We had the worst zombies, the worst policemen, now we've got the worst aliens. The blanks, I mean, there is that sort of threat and tension when you see a lot of them lined up with their eyes and mouths glowing blue, and they're all sort of doing a charging run at you. That's quite an imposing visual. I like that visual. It's undermined by the bloody statue that couldn't see anything in front of its own nose. But when the heads pop off and you see that the actor, the face expressions are all still there going, that's nice and creepy. And then after the big fight in the beehive, they essentially, by the way, remember, these guys are drunk and they're fighting really well against a lot of foes, which are presumably sober. They destroy all of these blanks, and then all of the blanks walk in again and they're all fine.
Yeah, they actually fight better the more drunk they are, because in the first altercation, they're absolutely getting their asses handed to them. Yet when they're in the beehive later on, it's more like the Matrix.
Yeah,
it's the sort of thing that usually, that kind of thing would pull me out of it too much. I mean, that's too silly. I didn't really mind it here because the fighting's always a little bit scrappy. Mm. Like, it's very improvised and things, like, or at least in terms of what it's meant to be for characters. Obviously, it's very tightly choreographed, but they managed to give it quite a raw look. Like, I really enjoy when Edgar Wright does his long, sustained shots, and the toilet scene's a really good example of that. You know, we're just kind of, we're right in the thick of the action. You're seeing bodies getting flung all over the place. You've got Martin Freeman trying to hide and stuff like that. And, that whole bit where Andy comes through to, like, shout, and then, he's about to let Gary properly have it. He's like, this guy's head's just come off, right? Like, the bit where all the bodies suddenly, like, they put their hands out and come towards them and things, it really does look quite imposing. I think it works brilliantly.
Yeah, it does. It does get a little bit creepy at times. You know, the eyes light up, and they've got that horrible sound. Occasionally, like a dial tone as well. And yeah, as I said before, it seems like the further on this pub crawl they get, the more capable they become of stopping them. But there's some great visual gags in the fights as well, especially where you've got Gary trying to have that pint whilst they're all trying to beat him up. And there's just all that great choreography of him trying to hold his beer whilst also taking on these blanks. It's just fantastic. It's just some great visual gags. And as you say, there's a lot of slapstick in this one. And normally I'm not a fan of it, but here it just works really well.
I think with the alien design, it reminds me of, have you seen Attack the Block yet?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yes, brilliant.
Yeah, like, because if that, again, it's a sort of a simplicity with the design, but they've made something quite memorable as well. And Attack the Block is also a really, really good movie, and, you know, strongly recommended for anyone who's not seen it. But like this, there's a lot of serious subtext in the film that manages to work into the alien plot really, really well.
Yeah, and funnily enough, it's the new Shaun of the Dead, according to the blurb on the Blu-ray cover as well.
You can see how John Boyega's career just took off from that. You know, like, I loved that, obviously I'm not going to go into spoiler territory in that one because it's not advertised as one of the films we're talking about, but the last scene of Attack the Block, that was a really good character moment. And yeah, basically, if anyone's not seen Attack the Block, watch it. It's the world's end. There's something that's quite amusing about watching this film nowadays. When I first saw this, we got the bit where we're talking about meeting up again. Is it Paddy Considine's character goes, 12 pints is insane, right? And when I was young, I was like, and then like watching it go, now I go, yeah.
Well, I've got to say, even back then, like just the thought of 12 pints, you know, I don't think I've ever had that in my entire life. But like, as the story goes, you know, they don't make it all the way to the world's end, which is that white whale, which Gary is clinging on to, isn't it? So,
I think he has 11 pints in it when he gets to the last one, because he's actually one of them because he's been kicked out, but then he drinks other people's pints.
Yeah,
it's very classic.
Drinks from the table outside.
Yeah,
that's a famous cock, because he won't serve him over there. So yes, he makes that one up, but then it's because he can't finish the one at the world's end. But when they're going out to get the water at the end, like you're like, okay, it's progress. It's not much progress.
Oh no, he's nothing but liability. You see, the one good thing, the one positive character arc in this film is Rosamund Pike and getting together with her high school sweetheart, like that relationship happening, which Simon Pegg's character, Gary King, actively, to use a phrase, cock blocks. I mean, he's actually hindering the one positive. This is why I don't like the character. He's actively hindering the one good character arc in that movie.
Wait, I'll tell you guys a good bit of foreshadowing, which I did not notice until this watch. The bit where they're arguing in the car about the amount of musketeers there are, and he says, they should have had 5 musketeers because you could lose 2 and still be left with 3. Then what happens? They lose 2 because they lose Martin Freeman and Eddie Marsden's characters, Ollie and Peter, and they're left with the 3 at the end. So I was like, all right, that works. But with the ending, right, so where I would... I agree it's a bit of a... It's not a nice ending, right? It ends in a downer. But at the same time, it still sticks to this idea of losing your sense of identity when it comes to conformity. So you're juxtaposing the idea of the aliens trying to enforce conformity on everyone, but also this idea of like the way that you conform as you get older. You lose the sense of freedom, you lose the sense of who you are, you lose the sense of your aspirations because you're doing the regular 9-to-5 and stuff like that, right? And you've got all these other characters that are successful, they are doing what society wants them to, but they're also not happy about it. So at the end, when the aliens are saying, we want to impose this upon everyone, I think them being defiant is almost a happy moment. You know, it's saying, fuck it, you can't just, you've got to still just to give the middle finger to the idea of having to grow up in this way. You know, they find this sort of when it goes back to feudal times, you know, Nick Frost, Andrew, which, don't be wrong, it is telling actually that this is a movie where I will trip over the character names, because Xandy is not as well pronounced as either Ed or Danny, actually, as Nick Frost role. Mm. But I mean, Nick Frost is playing the straight man in this one. But anyway, you know, he talks about this in terms of over worse on benefits. Change. You know, everyone returns to what's sort of more important for them. So it's quite bittersweet. Something would have been nice, right? You know, at the end where they say, yeah, stop starbucking us, man, right? They use the phrase starbucking. They should have said Weatherspoon.
Don't remember yeah, that
was a good visual gag with the first two pubs. They've returned home and none of them remember it because they've just been gentrified, basically.
With the others, I think you also get some quite nice moments of rapport where, like, they play up the slightly awkward banter when they first meet each other again, and, you know, no one's really sure why they're there. Then as it goes on, you know, when you see, although it's a bit sad watching men in their 40s kind of talking about, oh yeah, I remember when we did this 25 years ago or whatever, that's still the bits where the characters kind of come more alive, you know, they are fondly reminiscing and things. And it is, again, that love-hate relationship with the past that, you know, maybe when you are stuck in a boring job or something like that, then maybe there is a lot of fun and value about reconnecting with kind of a more sort of free point in your life, I guess, you know, maybe a more carefree point in your life. But at the same time, taken to the other extreme, you end up like Gary. And I like that it does have that bittersweetness. It does kind of come down to this idea of saying, yeah, you know, there's merit to all this. You know, yeah, maybe you do sort of lose sight of like bits of yourself as you get older. You know, maybe you do find yourself conforming and doing things you don't hugely like. But at the same time, it's all, and maybe it would be good to just kind of kick loose and like just do your own thing. But at the same time, it is also saying, but you can't just do that all the time, otherwise this is what your life looks like, you know? A guy you peaked in high school, or to use a metaphor from a movie, a straw dog, you know, it's, you know, if you explain the Straw Dogs remake, the ritual of the straw dogs, the beginning, they're important very early on in the ritual, and then there's nothing there any longer, they're just kind of tossed to the side. And that's exactly what's happened with Gary here. You know, he was like, oh, I'm cool. You know, everyone wants to be part of my crew. And now, he just looks pathetic.
Well, yeah, and it's obviously discussed later on when they're hiding out in the bullshit that Gary's lifestyle did have detrimental consequences on his inner circle as well. So, he's living it up, but it's having the opposite negative effect on his good friends.
Yeah, and that bit, like, where Nick Frost is talking about how you, like, you know, drink driving under the influence and just fucks off, yeah. Right? You know, it's again, it's a reminder of this guy is pretty horrible. With Nick Frost, his kind of, I suppose his arc is it's sort of done off screen, right? You know, where you're looking at this guy who gives a speech about making his marriage work and things. And we know that he isn't happy from earlier on in the film, but then you've got he punches his wedding ring out of the stomach of one of the sirens from earlier on in the movie. I thought that was quite nice. You know, that's him going back to his commitment again. And that bit in the pub, brilliant scene.
I love that you say that bit in the pub.
Their conversation, like, where he's all like, you know, my wife left me and stuff like that. Things aren't as great as they look for him either, you know? And I thought that was really well done. Basically, this is a 5-star film in my opinion.
It's definitely got its moments. It's not a 5-star film for me. After a whole star just for their criminal underusage of Pierce Brosnan. but this one, where I sort of find it a bit difficult to assign a star ratings, because this film certainly did have, I think, something more to say than what the other two films did. I mean, one film's message perhaps could be summarized as grow up, and another film's message could be summarized as loosen up a little. This one, this is where you've already failed on how to deal with that. and he's handling it the wrong way. He's trying to recapture what was the... By the way, that was also a good gag in this film, I'd say, is the opening sequence where he's talking about the night out he had with his friends 20 years ago, and you see that he's opening up about this in recovery. And he's talking about how good it was to have alcohol. But to have peaked that young and on that night out, that is something. And obviously the whole night out that they had and that montage at the beginning's set up for what will happen throughout the movie, but it's...
it's good because, like, you know, every pub crawl, there's the slightly self-destructive element of it if you're going to be drinking 12 pints. And really, this is a film about a guy dealing with his own self-destruction here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's... I mean, I guess if he learns anything from the whole experience, it's some degree about personal responsibility and sort of sense of ownership here, you know? I don't think it's saying back off government as such. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's saying, like, back off big state. But I think what it certainly is doing is playing with this sort of idea of society's expectations for how you live and how you retain your individuality in that society. You know, So I agree, it's difficult to sort of really pinpoint what the message is. I suppose it's maybe almost to be responsible or think about the consequences of your actions and others, but at the same time, try and keep in touch with the best bits of yourself, you know?
Yeah.
What about you, Jim? How many stars are you going to give
this? I'll give it a 4.
Yeah. Al, were you actually a 4 as well, by the way? Because you said it's not 5.
I'm teetering between 3.5 and 4.
Yeah, jeez. Definitely 4.
I'll go 4. Because, as I say, the film it does have something to say, and I do respect the film for that. Sorry, I only go to Jim.
As I said before, it's a deeper film than the other two. Not anywhere near as laugh-out-loud funny as the other two either. So I think that's where it didn't meet expectations from my point of view. It's still a very entertaining film, a great film as well, no doubt about it. Fantastic cast, great story. But, yeah, it just... kind of falls a bit short when you compare it against the other two in the trilogy.
Well, folks, we're going to see this through to the bitter end, or lager end, as we say. Let's do our top 10. Be looking at a list of the best Simon Pegg films. So, what I have here is a list from throughtheclutter.com, and what they have is the top 47 Simon Pegg films. Now, this is based, look at what the first top 10 is. This ranking is based on an algorithm that combines various factors, including the votes of users and search trends on the internet. So, what do we think is going to be in the top 10 Simon Pegg films? Keep in mind, he's done quite a lot of very...
Yeah.
Mission Impossible, so he'll have to be in there somewhere.
Which Mission Impossible?
The ones with Simon Pegg. He's in more than one.
Yeah, because what I will say is there's multiple Mission Impossibles in the top 10.
I'm going to go with Fallout is one of them.
Ghost Protocol.
That's the best one.
Yes, both right.
And Paul?
Paul is indeed in the top 10. Is Paul any good? I never watched it.
It's very good, but it's practically devised of film quotes. So
so this is a movie comprising of movie quotes. This is like a KFC chicken that is eating other KFC chickens to put itself into the KFC market.
This is actually a pretty poor list, because one of these films really isn't very good at all.
Star Trek Into Darkness?
I love that that's on this list. Oh my god.
Fucking number 4.
Number 4. That film is trying to be The Wrath of Khan. It is no Wrath of Khan. Only The Wrath of Khan had the wrath and Khan in it. and I actually mean that on both accounts.
I mean, that was simply just a bad movie.
Yeah. That was a film that its only selling points were what South Park lovingly call member berries. And by the way, the member berries were the highlights of that bloody film.
Okay, another of these films probably shouldn't be on here. It's another franchise one.
Simon Pegg was also in Star Wars.
He was indeed.
Force Awakens. Of course.
Yes, Star Wars The Force Awakens.
One
for top 10 list. Number
that
six.
That film, for me, as a star rating, it only gets one quarter portion.
So, I'll give you the rundown here. At number 10 is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Decent movie. Number 9 is The World's End. Oh, yeah, yeah. So all three of these appear.
Oh, yeah. We
expected. Yeah.
Me and Jim knew that.
Ghost Protocol's number 8. Number 7, Paul. Number 6, Force Awakens. Number 5, Mission Impossible Fallout. Number 4, Star Trek Into Darkness.
I mean, I'm sorry, but the Star Trek 2009 was a better film than Into Darkness, and Star Trek Beyond was a better film than Star Trek Into Darkness. Star Trek Into Darkness couldn't even get the punctuation right, because everyone's looking at the title thinking, there should be a colon in here somewhere. Star Trek Into Darkness. We need to separate the main title from the subtitle. But they decided not to do that.
Number 3 is Star Trek 2009. I really enjoyed that. Great, a really good film. Number 2 is Shaun of the Dead, so number 1 is Hot Fuzz. And that is our list. I also looked up, by the way, a wee ranking of Edgar Wright's films. Now, obviously there isn't 10 of them, he's only made 7.
Scott Pilgrim?
It's got to be number 1.
That's a damn good film, yeah.
I've actually never seen it, but it is not number 1 here.
Then the list's broken, I'm afraid.
Jim's right. I'm on Team Jim. Damn it, Jim.
So, number 1 is his documentary about the band Sparks.
Not long hit Netflix or Amazon, one of those.
Well, they have for their ranking, so movieweb.com, they have number 7 is Last Night in Soho. They call it the worst of his films. I really enjoyed Last Night in Soho and made my best of the year list for last year. Number 6 they have is The World's End. Of course, you know my feelings of that one.
Yep.
Number 5 they have is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
The world
is a very big adversary.
Number 4 is Hot Fuzz. Number 3 is Shaun of the Dead. Number 2 is Baby Driver, which I've also not seen.
Again, that's a decent film, but to put that above Scott Pilgrim and
sacrilege.
And Shaun of the Dead and all that. Yeah, just crazy.
I believe with Baby Driver, because after he'd left Ant-Man due to creative differences, I believe what he was saying with Baby Driver, he was really grateful to sort of have this basically all ready to go, because it meant that as Ant-Man was coming out, he was able to sort of, you know, he's able to invest in this other project. Mm. And then when it came out to really good reviews, he was happy about it. You know, it's like, all right, well, I didn't get to do that, but I did get to create this. It's probably a bit unfortunate that you've got Kevin Spacey.
Yes, definitely a big elephant in the room.
This is Kevin, I'm invading your Spacey.
Yes. The thing is, Kevin Spacey, you know, he was a very, very gifted actor. And obviously, his films are rightfully sullied right now. But indeed. At the same time, when he was at his peak, you know, he was excellent. You know, Glengarry Glen Ross, American Beauty.
Yeah, it's an amazing film. It's unfortunate, really, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so basically, it's pretty much the end of this show. I think it's been a good one.
Yes.
What I would ask is, if they were to come back and do any other type of film together, what sort of genre would you like to see these guys working in? Because I think a murder mystery could be quite fun.
Well, I'm sort of, I think we've answered this one for me, certainly at the very start, when we said From Dusk Till Shaun. I'm not being funny, but I would actually quite like to see what that film would look like. I would.
And I remember, Alistair, a while back, you were telling me about what maybe could be quite a fun multiverse movie would be Simon Skinner is a baddie and being investigated by the two cops from Hellraiser 6.
Do you know what I was thinking about, actually, was if there was some way that the Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and World's End, like, the universes were all, like connected, but that it just wouldn't work, because you would have to acknowledge the zombie apocalypse in Hot Fuzz and the World's End.
Yeah.
And, okay, the World's End ends on an alien invasion, which has an EMP. Although the electromagnetic pulse technically wouldn't slow down zombies, so you'd still have that apocalypse. Just don't talk about the zombie apocalypse. Just don't talk about it. But it would also mean that, like, the lowest stakes entry in the series was Hot Fuzz, because you're only dealing with a town full of homicidal maniacs. I nearly said homeopaths. And that's the wrong word. The zombie apocalypse is a big thing. An alien invasion, the EMPs, I mean, people are going to notice they can't access Facebook. Mm. And just a village of homicidal maniacs. And that's low stakes relatively compared to the other two films. But if there was a way that the three universes, like Nicholas Angel teaming up with Shaun of the Dead to take down Gary Kane, I'd watch that film.
I would like to see what happens when Danny meets Ed. A sort of lovable asshole and the kind of cuddlier one.
They'd get on like a house on fire. Even though, for continuity, Nick Frost's Ed from Shaun of the Dead would still have to be a zombie. But what I would quite like as a gag would be that his being a zombie has not even remotely impacted his character arc.
I also imagine that Danny probably wouldn't notice as well. Jim, what about yourself? What sort of genre would you want to see them work in if you were doing another of these?
Oh, I've kind of dabbled in all the good ones, haven't they? Maybe a Fast and Furious, but which end of the scale, the street racing or the international espionage? Maybe.
it's tough. At this point, it's tough to know what genre that movie series is. Did you know in the last film, one of the cars goes into space?
I've seen that.
What genre is this? What is this?
It's ridiculous. It's nearly 3 hours long, and it's fantastic. They've got one more film left in them, but they've no world left to conquer, so I'm looking forward to where it goes next.
Gone to space.
Speaking of things that are ridiculous and almost 3 hours long, we are reaching the end of the podcast. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. It's been our absolute pleasure hanging around speaking about these movies. Sorry it's been so long. It will not be the same delay till the next time around. Alistair, Jim, been an absolute pleasure. And shall see you guys later.
Thank you,
everyone. Bye. And reviews, check out horrorcallfilms.co.uk. White Bat Audio.